All right, this may be one of those cases in which introductions are almost superfluous in any way. I won't do justice to it. But it gives me great pleasure tonight to introduce Dr. Butler Lamson, a product of Berkeley's own EECS program and also a faculty member on the campus for some time. He's a founding member of Xerox PARC. You'll hear about that tonight. Expertise and a pioneering figure in things ranging from laser printers to WYSIWYG text formatting programs and the Ethernet. He's a member of the National Academy of Engineering, a fellow of the Association for Computing Machinery, and he's currently an architect at Microsoft and an adjunct professor of computer science and engineering at MIT. As I say, that's my poor attempt. I can't do justice to him, but I do want to hear what he says. So please welcome Dr. Butler Lamson.
Now, I promised me I'd get a toy that I can scribble on. Is that right?
Yes.
How does
Don't
it work?
Hurt yourself.
All right. Can I unplug it?
I think that would frighten the...
So I have to stand here if I want to scribble on it.
Yeah, but
oh,
if
dear.
You touch this, it advances. So. And if you dip in here, you get color.
Okay.
And you can erase, too, if you...
Spectacular. Okay.
The idea of me instructing you on technology on film is just wonderful.
All right, so let's see. I push this button. There we go. So, I hope people are going to ask lots of questions, because there's many, many,
and
many things.
My first question, Butler, where'd you go?
All right.
Thank you.
I think this automated multi-room system needs some substantial improvement. Because I like to pace up and down, and I was hoping to be able to sit down for some of this 3 hours. And lots of things that are apparently not in the cards.
By version 3, it will be great.
It is working. I'm going to go over here. It's going to work. Oh, that's great. That's much better. There's lots of things to say about what happened at PARC in the 70s and where it went subsequently. And I made a selection of things that I put into the slides, but there's lots of things that I could talk about. So you should ask questions, especially if you think that I've started off down a line that isn't very interesting. So it seemed like a good place to start was with the things that we had in our backgrounds when we went to PARC. And there were really, there were a bunch of threads which I've enumerated here, but they all grew out of the research programs that ARPA sponsored in universities during the 1960s. So a number of us came from Berkeley, where we had worked on the so-called Genie project that developed a computer system that became the STS-940, which was the first time-sharing system that you could actually buy, as opposed to having to build yourself. And quite a few companies actually did buy them, including some that set up in the Service Bureau business. And the people who did that work at Berkeley, of course, we wanted to do a second-generation system. You always want to do a second-generation system. And we tried fairly hard to do that system at Berkeley, but, of course, second-generation systems are always much more ambitious than first-generation systems, and we learned that it was too hard to do it within the constraints of the university. You know, you can only pay people a certain amount of money, and there's all kinds of process and one thing and another. And we tried to partner with a couple of companies to do it, and it didn't work out. So eventually we did a startup. Startups in 1969 were not exactly the way they are now. There really wasn't a venture capital industry at all. We got our startup money initially from a firm called Data Processing Financial and General, which had struck it rich leasing IBM computers, which seemed like a completely crackpot thing, because after all, IBM was making the computers and they were leasing them themselves. And in order to be in the leasing business, you had to buy an IBM computer and then lease it out. And how could you possibly do this for less than what IBM was charging? Well, it turned out you could arbitrage. IBM had some religion about how you were supposed to set the leasing charges. And the religion was wrong. and the leasing companies were able to take advantage of this. So DPF&G made a lot of money, and they were prepared to put a couple of $1 million of it into the Berkeley Computer Corporation. And later on, when we needed more money, we got the University of California Pension System, or endowment or something, to put another couple million in. And we went through that $4 million, and we actually built a system that worked, but commercially it was nonsense. It was this classic mistake that techies make when they do startups, which is, now if you do a startup, you should not have any technology problems. All that stuff should be under control, because there are so many other things that can go wrong. Well, the reason we were doing the startup was that we wanted to do research in building time-sharing systems. It was definitely not the case that we had all the technology problems licked. So we put most of our energy into the technology problems, and we solved a great many of them, but the net result was not a commercial success. So,
Butler, who was faculty and who was students then at Berkeley?
Who was faculty? Wayne Lichtenberger was on the faculty. Mel Pirtle was not a... He was a graduate student for a while, and then he was some sort of research scientist or something. He was not on the faculty. I was started out in the Gini project as a graduate student and eventually became a faculty member. Peter Deutsch was an undergraduate. I don't think there were any other faculty members involved in it more or less full time. Isn't that right, Marty?
Not
that.
Paul Moore was heavily involved.
There were some other people that were involved in more or less.
And Pearl became an associate professor.
Oh, he did? I'd forgotten that.
Sorry, could you repeat what Marty said?
Marty says that Mel Pirtle became an associate professor, which I didn't know, or had forgotten. Must have known. So anyway, there we were at the end of 1970, and the Berkeley Computer Corporation was in the...
Wait, I have a serious CTSS question for a second. What was it compatible with?
What was it compatible with? I believe the answer is it was more or less compatible with programs that you'd already written to run on the 7090.
Okay.
Although I'm very hazy about the details of that. I was never a user of CTSS.
All right.
But CTSS was a big influence on the Berkeley system, and therefore on us. And it was also a big influence on the whole community. So anyway, there were half a dozen of us that had been at Berkeley and then were at BCC, and Bob Taylor came along and scooped us up, and so he got our background. But there were some other things as well. Let's see, what else do I have on this list?
I'm sorry, Butler, one other question. When was Bob at DARPA relative to when he started PARC? Immediately before, or was there a gap?
After he left ARPA, he spent a year at the University of Utah, and then he went to PARC. So the other things, there was Doug Engelbart's online system. I don't know if anybody has talked about that in this course.
No, we will show the video later, but we haven't, so you should talk about it.
That was an enormously influential system. Doug was the first person to have the idea that you could have a computer system with the property that several people could sit in front of screens with keyboards and collaboratively work on an array of stuff that was stored in the computer. So he had he built what he called the online system, and he actually built it. The version of it that was successful was actually built on a 940. He bought a 940 to run it on. And a couple of us actually worked for Doug part-time during the summer when we were graduate students. And he built this quite amazing system which had the aspect of it that he was most interested in was that it had what you would now think of as an outlining system, and it had what you now think of as hyperlinks. So you could have this mass of documents in the computer, and you could expand and collapse the parts that were being displayed to you, and you could see them in reasonably readable form on these reasonably decent-looking screens. And furthermore, people could collaborate, and you could click on parts of these things, and you could jump to other linked stuff. So anyway, nowadays this is all old hat. It's just what you get on the web. But Doug actually built this system and got it all to work and gave an absolutely spectacular demonstration at the 1968 Fall Joint Computer Conference.
So I thought of that as being the sort of the NLS and mouse and QWERTY keyboard demo, but what you're saying is there's a whole lot more behind it, in fact.
Yeah, those hardware things were the least interesting part of it.
Where was he based at that time?
SRI.
Still at SRI.
Yes, he was at SRI. He did all this work at SRI, and he stayed at SRI for a long time.
Right. So question for you, Doug.
And this had a huge influence on anyone that was interested in using the computer as a communication tool. Yes?
You mentioned that as a grad student you worked for Engelbart.
Mm-hmm.
And so you went there at SRI during summer school?
Yeah. Yeah, I would go down there. I would drive down there. And I wrote about 9/10 of a snowball system for his CDC-3100, which was the machine he had before the 940. I don't think it was ever actually finished.
So let me ask another question. When I was at Brown in the late 60s, Van Damme was in cahoots with Ted Nelson,
mm-hmm.
who had written these papers about hypertext. Mm-hmm. Where do Nelson and Engelbart intersect?
Well, I had never heard of Nelson until many years later, and I don't know where Nelson and Engelbart intersect. Anybody know?
I do. Doug and Ted are both considered the authors of hypertext. So they co-created hypertext, and they both give each other credit.
Did they ever work together or even know about each other at the time?
They never worked each other, but they knew about each other's work. And Ted was doing his Xanadu project idea, and Doug was actually trying to make it work.
Yeah, right. There's a wonderful quote from Ted Nelson that was on the whiteboard of one of my colleagues at the DEC lab in Cambridge a few years ago. He said, "I mistook a clear vision for a short distance." Because Ted proposed all this stuff in the late 60s, and it was many years before it became realized.
So he had a big falling out with Van Damme over the compromises Van Damme had to make in order to get a functioning implementation.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Right, it was very ugly. They didn't talk for about 15 years, and Andy gave Ted complete credit for, you know, he was Andy's source of the idea. Andy never claimed that it was his idea, but the idea of making this thing run on a 360 with a 2250 display meant that you had to leave a lot of the hoo-ha on the cutting room floor, and that just aggravated Ted no end.
Right. Well, Engelbart didn't have that problem because he had this custom-built display system. It was actually based on drawing the characters on a CRT, but then he had TV cameras that looked at the CRT and turned green on black into black on white, which is what you prefer to look at. And he had a video switch so that you could actually have pictures of your collaborators on the screen along with the text that you were collaborating on. It was all incredibly cool. And I think it made a huge impression on many of the people who started Park. And in fact, some of the people who started the computer work at Park moved there from SRI because Doug started to get has always been fairly religious, and he got a little more religious after this big success, and I think some of his collaborators felt that they couldn't work with him effectively anymore, and they saw Park as a great opportunity to do something in a somewhat less religious way. So anyway, that was that. Then there was Alan Kay and his Flex machine.
Question?
Yes.
Okay. Did Robert Taylor ever attempt to get Doug Engelbart to come to Park?
Not that I am aware of. That would not have been a good idea.
Although Terry was religious in his own way.
Yeah, I mean, Doug is very strong-minded. And one of the things that made the computer science lab at Park successful was that we definitely practiced groupthink. We didn't practice total groupthink, but you had to basically be in tune with the way things were done, or you would be uncomfortable and you would leave. And it's just unthinkable that Doug would submit to groupthink. Well, I mean, he had his own groupthink, but he was the boss of it. So no, that would never have worked. I think Taylor almost certainly realized that it wouldn't work, and I don't think Doug would have really entertained it unless he'd been made an offer to essentially come to Park and do his own thing.
Was he aware of what you were working on at Park?
Oh, yeah, we communicated with him a lot. Absolutely. But our interests were not exactly the same, because our charter from Xerox was to build the electronic office, whatever that was. Nobody really knew what it was, but Xerox had this very far-sighted notion that eventually the gold mine and copiers, light lens copiers, would run dry. What do mines do? They don't run dry. They What do they do?
Run out of toner.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. They run out of toner.
I think there's still plenty of toner. And they should, while they were rich, they should spend some money on doing the next thing. And they were clever enough to figure out that the next thing would involve applying computers to offices. And beyond that, they really didn't have a clue. So they chartered us to do that. So we were very interested in that aspect of things. And we were also interested in the things you can do with time-sharing, right? And especially things like what's now called word processing. And what Doug was interested in was this, what he calls augmenting human intellect. And he interpreted that as constructing systems that would make it possible for people to collaborate effectively. We weren't terribly interested in that. We never did a whole lot along those lines. The kind of collaboration you could do with the systems that were built at Park was of the form, write a nice document and send it to somebody, and then they could maybe edit it and send it back. And that was definitely not Doug's model. He had much more profound ideas, which I didn't think were terribly practical, and I don't think it's worked out terribly well. So then there was Alan Kay and his Flex Machine. Alan's dream was that I'm sure that many of you have seen the pictures of the 12-year-old sitting under the tree holding the Dynabook in his lap or her lap, whichever it was, and scribbling on it with the stylus. And you know, a few years ago, we actually built tablet PCs that more or less realized all of that. Although, of course, Alan is not at all happy with them because he wants it to be much more wonderful than it is. And Alan was a considerable inspiration to us in a variety of ways, some of which I'll talk about. But he had his own thread of development, which I'm only going to touch on, because that was done in an organization that was parallel to the one I was in at Park, but not the same. And then, of course, there was the ARPANET and the Aloha Packet Radio Net, which were had a big influence on the way we approached networking, which was a very important thing for us, as we'll see in a minute. So those were the main things that people brought to the party when they came to Park. Okay, this picture is kind of interesting. This is a piece of a bigger picture, which I will show you all up at the end. You can't really read it, but you can sort of get the idea. The red oval encloses all the things that we did at Park, and in a few cases, an auxiliary organization. And the stuff above that is things that fed into us, and the stuff below that is things that we fed. So you can see Vannevar Bush's Memex article from 1945, and Sketchpad. Sketchpad wasn't on the previous list, I don't think, but it should have been. Ivan Sutherland's Sketchpad system was also a big influence on us. He really started computer graphics. And since we were very interested in how computers can communicate with people, we took the attitude that the primary medium for that communication was going to be things on the screen. We were very interested in computer graphics. And then there was Alan Kay's Reactive Engine, there was Simula, there was Doug's online system, and there were time-sharing systems, which don't really show in this picture, but they should. So this sort of gives you a flavor, and the complete picture goes on for down to about here, and we'll see it all at the end, but then it'll be even less readable. Just a few words about how the computer part of Park was organized. Park actually is not all about computers. There was a sizable, and still is, a sizable physics lab. And at that time, I don't know what's happened to it, but at that time, a fairly good-sized optics lab. And the computing was divided up between the computer science lab and the system science lab according to principles that seemed clear to the people who set it up, but rapidly became totally opaque. And in CSL, it just happened to work out this way. In CSL, we built the base hardware that turned out to be used. SSL guys built a lot of computing hardware, too, but it didn't work out. We built the operating system and the programming languages, and we worked on printers, which SSL guys also worked on very heavily, in fact, more than us. We worked on file servers. We did the networking. We built the Bravo, which was the editor essentially was the prototype for Microsoft Word, which still uses many of the data structures that Charles Simony and I invented for Bravo in the early 70s. We built Draw, which was sort of a prototype for Adobe Illustrator. We built the font system. We built the email system, both the server side and the client side. And I'll talk about all those things. And the SSL guys worked very hard on printing and some on file servers. They built the whole Smalltalk system. Alan Kay was in SSL. They built a system called Gypsy, which I'll have more to say about later, which had a big influence on Bravo and its successors. And they built the markup system, which was the prototype of today's paint programs. It's
so
a little misleading to say it was a prototype.
Are you
going
to relate the SSL printing and file servers to the CSL printing and file servers later?
Sorry, I missed the beginning of that question.
Are you going to help us understand the SSL printing and file servers versus the CSL printing and file servers?
It was entirely collaborative in those areas.
All right.
There were not separate efforts in those areas, but people from both labs worked on them. Okay, so that, I don't know how important that is, but I just thought I ought to say something about that. So here's the big picture timeline of what happened in this part of computing. This, of course, is not the whole story about what happened in computing for the last 40 years, but this is the story about this part. So in the 60s, we had time sharing, we had Doug Engelbart's online system, we had Sketchpad. In the 70s, we had Xerox PARC, where we did the Alto and the Ethernet and laser printers and all interactive applications and a lot of networking stuff. And at the same time, out in the outside world, people were building the first PCs, the Altair and the Apple II. And of course, the internet was being invented in the 1970s. And then in the 80s, we had the Xerox Star and the IBM PC. The Xerox Star was sort of the product version of the stuff that we had built at PARC in the 70s, and I have quite a bit to say about that. And you know about the IBM PC. It was sort of a souped-up Apple II. It's the way it started out. And then in 1984, there was the Macintosh, which was the first successful commercial realization of many of the ideas that we had. And the Apple LaserWriter, likewise, and Microsoft Word and Excel. And then in the 1990s, we had Windows finally became serious, and we had the World Wide Web. So that's the big picture.
Yeah, I was a little confused about what Sketchpad was in terms of the...
Sketchpad was the first serious computer graphics system. What you could do with Sketchpad, you could draw pictures.
It's what you're doing on the PC tablet today.
Well, not quite. Actually, in many respects, it was more sophisticated than that, because you could draw pictures and you could impose constraints. You could say, I want this line to be parallel to this one. There are systems today on the PC that allow you to do that, but they're fringe. But this was the first system that actually allowed you to interact in a meaningful way with the computer, other than by typing, by hitting keys on a keyboard.
Thank you.
And I recently discovered that somebody at Cambridge University in England has scanned in and OCR'd and generally beautified Ivan Sutherland's thesis on Sketchpad.
Oh, great.
There was never a paper, as far as I know, about Sketchpad, but there was an MIT thesis, and you can now find it on the web. And
right.
It's not even a crappy scanned version. It's been beautified.
If you take a look on Wikipedia, it's just look up Sketchpad. There's actually a link to that.
Oh, great. So you can find it from the Wikipedia entry. Okay, so that's the big picture, and I hope that will be helpful to you as I go along and plunge into details. What motivated us? We spent quite a bit of time thinking about what was important. And the kinds of things we thought were important were that computers should be viewed as communication devices. You know, classically, computers have been viewed as simulation devices. And you could simulate nuclear weapons or you could simulate payrolls, but that was a whole style of doing things which was very, very successful for a long time and is still very important. But until the late 60s, people didn't really think about using computers as communication devices. I think it's fair to say that aside from Vannevar Bush's Memex, it was Licklider who first had the idea that this was going to be extremely important. And of course, this has turned out to be the most important theme in computing in the last 25 or 30 years. So there was Licklider, and he started the ARPA time-sharing program, and Bob Taylor started the networking program, and then there was Engelbart and NLS, and Alan Kay and his Flex machines. And those were all the 1960s attempts to attack this broad problem of how do you use computers effectively as tools to help people think and communicate. And as I already discussed, what Xerox's angle on this is not exactly the same. And we didn't ask ourselves when we did something, gosh, is this going to make some major Xerox product come to market a year earlier than it would if we didn't undertake this enterprise. But we definitely kept in mind the fact that we were supposed to be figuring out what the office of the future, the electronic office, whatever it's going to be, was going to be like. We paid a lot of attention to that. So the slogan for what we did at PARC is personal distributed computing. And especially the personal and distributed parts of that are really important. The computing part is important in the sense that we all always thought in terms of building a general purpose system that you could program to do a wide variety of things. And of course, we did a huge amount of programming and we invested a lot in tools for programming, which you pretty much had to do in those days because the stuff you could get off the shelf was unbelievably awful. And nowadays, normally, you wouldn't combine a big investment in programming tools with an attempt to build a significant system. But you don't have to do that because there's a lot of stuff you can get off the shelf. But that was definitely not true in 1970. I have a vivid memory of programming the Data General Novas that we started out with in a Data General Algol 60, which was actually not a bad system, except it had the unpleasant property that it had a tendency to crash near the end of a compilation. And when it crashed, it often overwrote your files. So you had to be extremely careful in order to avoid losing your laboriously constructed program when you use this system. So that's the computing part. So the personal part, our notion was that the computing should be under the control of a person, it should serve the person's needs, and that, among other things, meant that the performance should be predictable enough. Now this was in a context where in 1970 you had two choices about how to do your computing. If you were an ordinary person, you did batch processing, which meant you key punched stuff up and you put it in through a window, and 2 hours later you got your deck and a listing of the output back. And if you were sophisticated, you did time sharing, which meant that you shared you had a writer-like terminal and you shared the machine with some large number of other people, and it was heavily overloaded and performance was very unpredictable. To the point where my colleague Bob Morris said that this was something that, as far as I know, was never implemented, but he said that every time sharing terminal should have a large red button on it, which you push when you're dissatisfied with the service. And the system at that point is supposed to do one of two things. It's either supposed to improve the service or throw you off. It should be fair. On the average, it should give everyone the same amount of service. So the notion is, if you're sitting there and you think you'd be more productive with a pencil, you should push the button. That was the world of time sharing. So the Alto, the idea was totally different. We want the performance to be predictable, and we want it to be fast enough. And that was revolutionary, too, because the mental model that people had at the time was that computers were fast, they can do lots of additions in a second, and people are slow. So no question about struggling for the computer, having to work hard to make the computer keep up with the person. But that was the only reason you could have that viewpoint was that the people were forced to play on the machine's terms. If you make the machine play on the people's terms, it's still beyond the state of the art for a machine to keep up. You know, it can't keep up with my speech, it can't understand my facial expressions, it can't really follow my gestures. It was a big challenge to make the machines fast enough. We wanted the system to be reasonably reliable and available so that it wasn't a toy but something you could actually use. And we wanted it to be not too hard to use. And ideally, we wanted it to be really easy to use. But that wasn't a super high priority for most of us. And distributed is the other thing. So what's the motivation for that? Well, number one, everything in the real world is distributed. And number two, if the computer's going to be a communication device, then unless you have the classical time-sharing model where everybody's connected to the same big box, you're kind of stuck with a distributed system. You're going to have that. And in addition to that, there were economic arguments because we had, even if we were going to give everybody their own computer, there were shared devices like printers that were very expensive. And you couldn't afford to give everyone their own printer. And besides, you wouldn't want your own one page a second Xerox copier in the office because it was kind of noisy and took up a lot of floor space. So those are the themes, personal distributed computing, and we'll see how they play out. So the personal part, we wanted to have information that would be convenient for a person. We wanted it to be universal. We didn't want.
Sorry, Butler, can I back up for just a second?
Yes.
So in the beginning, before anyone was thinking about Alto, you guys had like a rack of Novas in the basement, and you were pumping video up to TV screens.
No, we never did that. The SSL guys did that. They built a system called Polos, where they sort of signed up for the idea that a person should have their own computer, but their model was to be a bank of computers, and you would switch the output, and you assign a computer to a single person for some length of time. And the result of this was a system that was very complicated and spent most of its time trying to organize itself, and it wasn't successful.
Got it, because I remember that there was coax running through the building before there was Ethernet, and it was basically RG59 that was the video feed for these.
That's right. That's right. The Polos guys built sort of their version. They were the core of that group came, in fact, from Doug Engelbart's group, and they built a sort of early 70s version of Doug's system, where instead of having a 940 timesharing system, they had this bank of Novas. But then they had a video switch and all that stuff, just like Doug had done 5 years earlier.
Got it. But the CSL people were going to do workstations from when they arrived, essentially. You didn't call it that or something.
Well, no, we didn't actually know what we were going to do. When we arrived, the first thing we had to do was get a computer.
Right.
And of course, everybody knew what a computer was. It was a timesharing system.
Right.
And this is kind of an interesting story, which isn't on the slides, but it's
building Macs.
Maybe it's interesting from a non-technical point of view. bought a computer company about a year and a half previously. They bought a company called SDS. And this was one of the great swindles of computing. I mean, the extravagancy and foolishness of this purchase was not matched until the days of the internet bubble, I believe. Isn't that right? Can anybody think of any examples in between? They paid $1 billion in 1969 dollars, which is about $5 billion of today's dollars, for SDS, which was a company that was actually worth $100 million tops. And I found this out because I was at BCC at the time, and although I wasn't involved with the financial community, some of the other founders were, and I was chatting with them, and they told me that everyone in the then rather small part of the financial community that paid attention to technology things knew that Max Pilevsky, who was running SDS, was swindling Xerox. The Xeroxers were so arrogant that they never asked anybody what was going on. They knew what was the right thing to do, so they paid this $1 billion, and they bought this company, SDS was actually the company that built the 940 system. But they had built a second generation of machines, and they had built a bunch of timesharing software for them, more or less following in the footsteps of the 940. And of course, Xerox wanted us to buy one of their machines. We didn't want to do that, partly for technical reasons, but mainly for a non-technical reason, which was that the ARPA research community had pretty much standardized on DEC PDP-10s and the timesharing system for the 10 that was built by BBN called 10X. And we didn't want to be cut off from that community. So we decided that we could not get an SDS machine. We had to have a PDP-10. But unfortunately, the PDP-10 was the primary competitor in the market for SDS's main machine, which was called the Sigma 7. So I think probably if we had insisted, we would have been allowed to buy a PDP-10. But a lot of people would have been very mad at us if we'd done that. And we didn't think that was a good deal. So we decided to build one. We'd built computers before. We didn't think it was that big a deal. So we actually spent a large fraction of our first year. Most of the people who started CSL spent a large fraction of the first year building this computer.
Question from Microsoft?
Excuse me?
So question from Microsoft.
Yes.
So, since PARC was kind of the research arm for Xerox's foray into the computer industry, I'm curious why you guys weren't eager to work with SDS to...
Well, it wasn't that simple. We never would have signed up for being SDS's research arm. We were, in our view, which I think was shared by the Xerox senior management, PARC was chartered, our part of PARC was chartered to invent the office of the future. That was not what SDS was doing. Now, why Xerox bought SDS at all is completely unclear. They had this crackpot vision that because they were a successful office company, they could transform SDS, which was a fairly successful supplier of mid-range scientific computers, into a competitor to IBM. You know, a more crackpot notion you just could not imagine. There were so many things wrong with this idea that it would, you couldn't get all the main reasons why this could never work onto one page. But this was Xerox's vision, and it had nothing to do with the Office of the Future. And we were absolutely confident that it wouldn't work, and we distanced ourselves from it as aggressively as possible. And some people were unhappy about that, but that was unavoidable. If we'd gotten involved with SDS, it would have just been a catastrophe. And they went down the tubes about 3 years later, after Xerox had poured another $1 billion into trying to compete with IBM.
We had a Sigma 5. We went down the tubes with them.
The Sigma 5 was a perfectly good machine for some purposes, but it was just totally unsuitable for our purposes.
So let me ask another timing question. Thacker told me that in terms of sort of when to do the Alto, the hardware, and the bitmap graphics, it was simply understanding the cost of memory. And he felt you could only spend half the price of the computer on memory, and you needed a certain amount of memory for a reasonable size, reasonable resolution screen. From the beginning, were you committed to bitmap, or did you consider vector graphics?
Well, that's an interesting story, actually. So we built Max, and in parallel with that, of course, just building a time-sharing system didn't do much to advance the long-term goals that I enunciated. So in parallel with that, we were trying to figure out the answer to questions like, what are we going to use to present things to users? And we had bought an assortment of vector graphics hardware. Vector graphics is the old-fashioned way of doing computer graphics that predated bitmaps, where the notion, you basically took an oscilloscope, and what an oscilloscope lets you do is draw a point on the screen. You can light up one point, then you can move the beam around, and so you can make lines. And by making different shaped lines, you can make characters and assorted other things. And the basic problem with vector graphics is that if you want a picture that's twice as complicated, it takes twice as long to draw. And it was never fast enough. And so it was a constant struggle to get the vector graphics to draw as much stuff as you wanted to have. But it was pretty much the only thing that was around in the late 60s and early 70s. All computer graphics was done this way. And it was Chuck's brilliant insight that you could actually afford, with the price of memory in 1972, you could actually afford to have 64 kilobytes of memory devoted to providing one bit per pixel for a 600 by 800 display. And that was something that it just never really occurred to anyone before, as far as I know. Stanford AI Lab did have an interesting system that used a bitmap display, and they made it work by storing the bitmap on a disk. And they actually, it was a centralized system. They had, it was a fixed head disk, so there was one read head for every terminal in the system. And the read head read off one track of disk, and on one track of disk you had, 600 by 400 or something like that bitmap. That system had some obvious drawbacks having to do with the difficulty of refreshing it and a fairly crappy resolution in one thing and another. That was the other place where people actually did bitmap graphics at that time. Maybe even a little earlier than we did. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Marty.
When you talk about a computer company, there are really two separate parts. People doing the research and the technical and administrators. And a lot of the answers depend on the administrators not agreeing with the technical people. The question is, which of the two things happened? Generally, the disasters are where the administrators went out on both sides.
Well, that definitely happened with Xerox and SDS, because Xerox had this vision that they were going to compete with IBM, and I think the SDS engineers understood perfectly well that you couldn't make that work. But, you know, they'd been bought, and they had pretty much had to do what the new management said. So it wasn't really their fault, except that it's kind of unavoidable in situations like that after a while the engineers start to lie about what they can do. But it was completely Xerox's fault that this was such a disaster, because they set totally unrealistic goals any idiot could have told them couldn't possibly be achieved. Okay, so let's go on. So anyway, we wanted it to be universal. And the model we adopted, once we had this brilliant idea about the bitmap, was that we would have ink on paper. I mean, that's a tried and true metaphor. We could present more or less arbitrary images. And furthermore, you'd be able to point, using the mouse, you'd be able to point at places in those images. Everybody knows, by the way, that the mouse was not invented at Xerox PARC, right? Everybody knows that Doug Engelbart invented, and his guys invented the mouse. And in fact, they did a very careful study of pointing devices. They evaluated half a dozen different kinds of pointing devices, and they presented a fairly convincing argument why, of the pointing devices that were technically feasible in the late 60s, the mouse was the best. And the only competitor it had in any sense was a device called the RAM tablet, which was a device that actually use a pen to input absolute character coordinate positions to the computer. And the problem with the RAM tablet was it was essentially, the way it was built was that there was a grid, roughly 1,000 by 1,000 grid of wires, which you imposed suitable signals on, and then you could read out the position of the pen, and it was too expensive. It cost $10,000. And the other thing that's not so great about a pen scheme is that it's not very compatible with a keyboard. And the tablet PCs still have this problem. Yes?
Of the devices they tested, was the mouse the only prototype one, or were they all crazy new devices that no one had ever seen?
No, some of them were old devices, like light pens, but there were several new devices, I believe. I don't remember all the details. I'm sure that if you go to the Wikipedia article on NLS, you'll find a pointer to the paper. They wrote a very nice paper describing all the experiments that they've done.
I've actually held the first mouse. It was made out of wood. It has a red button.
That's right.
And some of the real neat features is you could tilt it on the side, and you could draw perfectly straight lines.
Yeah, because the original mouse did not have a ball. It had two orthogonal wheels, which were fairly sharp. So that if you moved it this way, this wheel would turn, and this one would drag. And if you moved it this way, they would both turn. But the ball was actually a much better way of doing it. Although it didn't have this wonderful feature that you just described, but in every other way it was much better. And I don't really know, Ron Ryder came up with the idea of the ball mouse at Park, and I don't know why the SRI guys never came up with it, but as far as I know they didn't, because Ron got a patent. And it's pretty obvious that you can have the same idea of having two takeoffs on the ball. Works much better. And so until optical mice came in, that was the way all mice were built. So anyway, that was the basic metaphor of Yalta. You've got paper with ink on it. And it was, Yalta was actually fairly good, subject to a couple of restrictions. You only had your choices of color where you could have black or white in each pixel. And you could have 600 by 800 give you a reasonable facsimile of an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. Resolution's not nearly as good as paper, of course. And you might ask, why not several bits per pixel? And the answer is you couldn't afford it. It was already half the memory of the iPhone at 1 bit per pixel. And, of course, there are other things you might like to have, like voice and other kinds of sound. And we de-emphasized those because we couldn't work on everything. So that's sort of the technical background. Now for the, philosophical background of how we did the Yalta system. Well, the first idea was this time machine idea, that by spending a lot of money, you could have the hardware that would be routine and cheap 10 years or 15 years in the future. And since it takes a long time to figure out how to use new hardware with significantly different capabilities, it's good to have a big jump. It's very, very unfortunate that you can't do this anymore. It's essentially impossible to spend money and get hardware that's dramatically better than what everyone else has, except for very specialized things like supercomputing. And that's too bad, because it means that, the flip side of it is that most of the hardware resources are being pissed away so aggressively that you don't really need hardware that's better than the hardware that everyone else has. You just have to use it a little bit more intelligently. But you can't really build this kind of time machine anymore, because the nature of the technology makes it impossible. But in those days, you definitely could. And we were prepared to spend $15,000 per person, which is about $60,000 per person in today's money. It seems like a lot by today's standards. But remember, in those days, computers were expensive. So that was a sizable amount of money, but it wasn't unthinkable. We were prepared to spend that much money to give everybody in the lab a machine that was roughly the equivalent of the Macintosh. In some respects, it was better. In some respects, it was not quite as good. And we'll see that in a minute. So time machine was the first thing. Simulate the future by spending money. Use what you build. This was very important to us. We felt that the only way to really figure out whether what you were building was any good was to try it out. And it's excruciatingly difficult to build something and get someone else to try it out and learn something from that. It's not impossible, but it's incredibly hard. You'll never understand how hard it is until you try it. So our idea was we were going to use the stuff ourselves, and that's how we would know whether it was good. And this worked out well for things that we cared about: text, pictures, printing, sound, email. It was no good for spreadsheets. We didn't do spreadsheets at Park. And it's pretty, we could have done spreadsheets on the Alto. And the Alto is a much better machine than the Apple II, on which spreadsheets were first done. We had no use for spreadsheets, so nobody was motivated to work on that.
So question from you, Doug, again.
Excuse me?
Would you say that that principle goes counter to the charter of Park to build the office of the people?
Well, yeah, it was, but we just never would have thought of spreadsheets because we didn't have any use for them. I don't know what we could have done. We did do two or three things that, in retrospect, you can sort of see were creeping up on the idea of spreadsheets, but we just weren't motivated enough. No, it would have been much better if we'd done spreadsheets, no question about it. And we didn't do, this wasn't particularly good for databases either, because we weren't very interested in that. Late in the 70s, we did build a fairly elaborate database system, but it never really got used in any serious way, because we didn't have any serious applications for databases. We did build an email system based on the database, and that was a bust. And the lesson I took away from that, this probably isn't true today, because the cost structure of the hardware is so different. But basically, databases don't have that much to contribute to email, because the schema for email is so simple that you don't get any mileage out of a database. You can get a lot of mileage out of full-text search, but not with the technology of the late 70s. So use what you build. Time machine, use what you build. Personal machine. People are fast, machines are slow. That was our motto. And predictability, very important. Otherwise, we just didn't feel that this whole notion of the computer as your daily tool, not as the thing that you programmed, just wouldn't be viable unless you could do this. And the other thing that was extremely important for the Alto was we did not have a grand plan for the system, and that was an explicit decision. We thought about whether there should be a grand plan and a lot of common library stuff and all kinds of integration and things, and we said, we're not going to do that, and we're not going to do it for two reasons. One was that we just didn't know enough, and the other was that you couldn't afford it. A serious Alto application used up all the cycles and all the RAM. And if you tried to do two applications at the same time, or if you paid any significant cost for common stuff that would help to tie the applications together that was not representable on the disk, then you wouldn't be able to do interesting applications, because there just weren't enough resources. Of course, this is something that's changed completely in the ensuing time. But at Park in the 70s, the only exception to that was the Smalltalk system. And the price they paid was a very sizable performance hit. So the result was... Hi, Rich. The result was that the Smalltalk people wrote their papers using Bravo. They didn't write them in the Smalltalk system, because it just wasn't... The performance wasn't good enough.
A question from you, Deb. Since the bitmap displays use so much memory, did you consider doing any sort of compression instead of storing every bit?
We did. The display had a very clever scheme by which you could divide the display up into horizontal strips. And for each strip, you only had to allocate it as much memory as you needed, starting at the left edge. And if you wanted to have, for example, a big black bar, that only took a couple of words. And Bravo took that was pretty useless for drawing programs. But for the editor, it was great, and Bravo took advantage of that. And in fact, as the Bravo editor would run, it would need more memory to represent the editing that you'd done. And so the number of lines it could display would shrink. And when it got down to only five or six lines, then you had to write the thing out and start over. And that was the way it worked. So yeah, compression beyond that, we really couldn't afford, because the state of the art in LSI in 1972 was pretty primitive. And we couldn't afford any compression hardware. And you had to be able to decompress in real time, otherwise it'd be useless. So that was really out of the question. But this particular thing that I just described was easy to do. And it was very, very important for the editor. And in general, it was good, because it meant that other programs typically couldn't use this horizontal strip trick very successfully, but you could say, I'm only going to have half a screen's worth of image because I need the rest of the memory for something else. And lots of people did that.
So I had an interactivity question. As I recall, Chuck stood on his head in order to make sure that the mouse always had priority so that whenever you moved it, it would track exactly what your hand did.
Yes, there was a hardware cursor, and this was done at a low level in the software, not actually in the hardware, but you could take the mouse coordinates and plug them into the registers that control the hardware cursor, and you could load up the hardware cursor with the little 16 by 16 image that you wanted, and by God, it tracked. And I was just horrified. When I left Xerox in 1984, which was 12 years after we designed the Alpha, and I came back for a visit 3 or 4 years later, and they were using Suns, and I was looking over somebody's shoulder, and I could see the guy's moving the mouse, and it couldn't track. What did they do wrong? I still have no idea.
So
it's the same in Windows. Windows can't track the mouse either, and I have no idea what Windows is doing wrong. It's just completely baffling.
So you may remember when I arrived at DeckCircuit 84, I brought a very early classic Mac with me, and Chuck took it apart and played with it, and the first thing that astonished him was that the mouse didn't track. Same deal.
I can't explain it. And it's extremely annoying. And it's so easy to fix. It's completely baffling. So no grand plan. The integration mechanism was what we called WorldSwap. And the way WorldSwap worked was there was a very tiny piece of code that was always there that was capable of writing the entire 128 kilobytes of memory out to the disk. That took about a second running the disk at full speed. We were very proud of the fact that we could run the disk at full speed. And then you could read in another complete memory image in a second. So you would go, this would go, and then you would have a different world. So you could swap back and forth between the debugger and the program you were working on, or between one application and another at the price of 2 seconds.
So that's a piece of the CTSS influence, right? Which was one, I mean, CTSS was swapping between users, but fundamentally it was one user in memory at a time, and you would swap
it wasn't,
that
actually.
Wasn't
one user in memory at a time. They could have multiple users in memory.
Okay.
The system that was one user in memory at the time was the APL 360 system.
Yeah.
And in fact, their criterion for success was the APL was originally implemented using IBM Selectric typewriters. So those are golf ball typewriters. So you typed along, and the golf ball would move along for a while, and then you'd push return, and it was the way the typewriter was physically built, the return was pretty slow. So it would go zzz, and their goal was to make it so that by the time the golf ball got back to the left margin and was in a position to type something, they had swapped you in and run the line that you just typed. And it wasn't too much computing. You could get the answer instantly. And they were very successful in that. That was brilliant. We didn't have that problem on the Alto because typically you did not use world swap to swap between two applications. Because 2 seconds is too long. Picture. Here's the Alto hardware.
Question from Microsoft. Question from Microsoft.
Yep.
I'm just curious. Back to slide there. You mentioned that you had little use for databases. Is that just because all the applications that were pursued, the data was largely unstructured, or?
Yes, and that's still true today.
Right.
I mean, there were applications for structured data. It's just we personally at Park weren't interested in them. So use what you build was not really an option.
Fair enough. And
furthermore, we had no good intuitions about what was important. So after we felt on sort of intellectual grounds that the idea of databases was important, and as I said, we built one in the late 70s, but it never actually got used for anything significant because we didn't have any interesting applications that we could think of. And looking
right.
back on it, I can't see what we did wrong.
No, in fact, it sounds like you took your one piece of sort of semi-structured data that you had, the email, and tried to cram it in there.
We tried that, and that was a bust. It was a big mistake to use the database system for email. It would have been a much better email system. The system we had before that didn't use the database was much more successful. I mean, the database email system worked, but it was much harder to build than it would have been if the database hadn't been there.
So was that sort of the end of any efforts to try and, you know, work with semi-structured data in a database, or was that the single attempt? Or?
Well, by the time this had all happened, it was 1984 and CSL dissolved, so I don't know what would have happened.
Fair enough.
If we stayed around. But I think it's pretty much still true. I mean, the most recent effort to use databases for something other than sort of classical database applications is a thing that Microsoft tried very hard to build in the last 5 years called WinFS, and it was a bust too.
I'm intimately familiar with that, so we can move on.
And the fundamental problem is clear. It's that, where are you going to get the structured data from? Well, the only possibility that I can see is you've got to compute it.
Yes.
And that is reasonably hard. And furthermore, it's not what people usually focus on when they go down this path. Okay. So here's the Alto. I can draw, right? That'll be exciting. This is the box that contains the processor, the electronics in the bottom part with this grill in front of it, and this top thing is the disk. That's a 2.5 megabyte disk. It was a cartridge disk about this big around, 14 inches around, I think.
We're
it was 14 inches.
Here.
It's about like this. And that was 2.5 megabytes, and that was
they're on the right-hand side in the picture, Butler.
Huh?
They're on the right-hand side behind the table leg. The disks.
Yes, right, disk packs. Thank you. Disk packs, right there. And many Altos had two, so then you had 5 megabytes. That was big. Here's the mouse. This was the... I think this is the first ball mouse that we built. Reasonably careful tooling and stuff. And here's a screen, 600 by 800, 1 bit per pixel in portrait mode, because we wanted to do 8.5 by 11 paper, remember?
Question from you, Doug?
So there's 128 kilobytes of RAM. That was the biggest limitation. It was Ethernet. It was a 3 megabit system, and it was shared by the 50 Altos in CSL. You could have multiple Ethernet segments that were tied together with routers, but all of CSL got by with one. And it cost about $12,000 to make in 1973 dollars. Yes, question.
Why did you decide particularly for a 3-button mode? Was there some reason for it? Or?
As opposed to what, 5?
2, maybe 1, 2, whatever.
4 buttons is better.
Yeah, I know, but if you... Okay.
Within some reasonable limit, Engelbart had a 3-button mouse, and we thought that was good. And we stuck with it. His buttons were... The first mouse that was built at Park was not this mouse. The first mouse that was built at Park was engineered... I think it was an orthogonal wheel mouse, and it was engineered by Bill English and the guys that came over from SRI, and they had the buttons arranged vertically, which is obviously not good because it's easy for your finger to do this, and it's hard for it to do that. So we switched to the horizontal layout for the buttons.
But
why Apple went in for one button, that is another one of the mysteries that I cannot explain.
Steve Jobs.
Well, yeah, but why? Generally, Steve's judgment is good. Here's a techie picture. This is the block diagram of the Alto, and it kind of shows you there's microcode. Is this visible? No. I have to write. All right, let's go to some other color. Blue. Here's the microcode, and here's the I/O part of the thing, and there's registers, and this is the compute part. You can see, as in most processors, that's not very important. And this is the interface to the RAM. And you can't really learn anything from this picture. This is an interesting chart. This proves that we were living in the future. Okay, because here's the Alto in 1974. If Altos had been sold, they would have cost about $40,000. 0.3 MIPS, a tenth of a megabyte of RAM, 2.5 megabytes of disk, and if you take the Ethernet and divide it up among the 50 machines, there's about 0.05 megabytes per second of Ethernet bandwidth. You have to convert from bits to bytes as well to get that number. In 1984, 10 years later, there was the Macintosh. It was $3,000. It was roughly equivalent to the Alto. It was faster, it had more memory, it had less disk, and it had slower networking. So, I tossed it all up and roughly equivalent to the Alto. 1995 PC, price stays the same. It's about 100 times as good as an Alto. Today's PC is a third the price, and it's about 10,000 times as good as the Alto. So an interesting question is, what is being done with that 10,000 times increase in hardware resources? And we'll come back to that question at the end.
The phrase is,
another
Gordon giveth, Bill taketh away.
Yeah, but not totally randomly. I mean, there are reasons why those things happen. Here's another hardware comparison. CPU clock speed hasn't increased that much, only by a factor of 500. The thing that's increased by the largest amount is the disk capacity, of course. So there were a few ideas behind the Alto hardware. One of them was it had to be simple, because it had to be cheap enough that we could afford to build a lot of them. And every gate was costly in 1972. We had the bitmap display. We already talked about that. It was programmable at all levels. It was a microcoded machine. The I.O. Was controlled by the microcode. That was one of the reasons that the display was flexible and yet cheap, because the actual job of fetching words out of the memory and passing them to the display was done by the same microcode engine that was used to execute instructions. You might have thought that that would be bad because it couldn't be executing instructions, but it couldn't be executing instructions anyway because it was fetching display words from the memory. And the memory only had one port, so you couldn't be fetching instructions and display words at the same time. If you had the full screen, two-thirds of the machine cycles went into refresh. So you could speed the machine up by a factor of 3 by turning off the display. And so we had microcode that, for several different instruction sets, we had the basic Nova instruction set, and we wrote our programs in a programming language called BCPL, which was compiled into Nova instructions. And then later on, we had much more carefully designed, much more space-optimized instruction sets for several different programming languages, Smalltalk, Lisp, and MASIC. And that was all done with the Alto microcode. It had flexible and powerful I.O. because of the fact that the I.O. was controlled by the microcode, and the microcode engine at its lowest level was able to switch its attention from one device to another in every microcycle without paying any overhead. You could do fairly fancy things by putting some of the work in the hardware, but doing most of the work in the microcode. And so we were able to build Ethernet controllers and laser printer controllers that were quite small and relatively cheap. And the other idea was that this is going to be a distributed system. The machine was going to be personal, but we were going to have a system, not just a whole bunch of isolated machines, because we were going to have networking. And we did that with Ethernet. That's why Ethernet was invented, because we really needed it for that. Where are we? Here. Okay, so a couple pictures. This is an Alto sort of in use. You can see the box is right here, and here's the display, and it's on a desk, and yada yada. Pretty familiar, but this was really, really cool in the mid-70s. And after we built 30 Altos just for CSL and a few of our friends, but subsequently we arranged for a sort of internal production line, and a couple thousand Altos were built, and they were definitely objects of desire within the Xerox Corporation. People would scrounge in their budgets for the $15,000 that it took to buy an Alto. And it was a real status symbol.
Quick question.
Ridiculous now, but this.
How much noise?
Nothing like this had ever been seen in the world before, so it was really made a big impact.
Quick question. How much noise did it make? Was it hot?
No, it was pretty quiet, and heat was not a significant issue. I mean, you could hear it, but people didn't really worry about it. Later machines that we built were much noisier and had to be put in a machine room. But the Alto didn't have that problem. Let's see. Here, this is a picture of an Alto sort of taken apart. Wait, as it says, the caption says, waiting to be restored. Here's Ethernet. That is a picture. The original Ethernet, there was an actual physical ether. It was a piece of coax that snaked around the building. And you connected these cable TV taps to it. The original idea was based on the Aloha packet radio system that was done at the University of Hawaii around 1970 by Norm Abramson and his collaborators. And the basic notion of that was, and this was the way the initial Ethernet worked, if you wanted to transmit, you just send. And later on you find out whether it worked out. This is Aloha. You just send, and later on you find out whether it worked out or not. And if it worked out, great. And if it didn't work out, well, then you wait a while and then you send again. And the Ethernet had a version of this that performs significantly better and is also somewhat easier to understand, which wasn't an option for the Aloha guys. Because on the Ethernet, you could tell if someone else was sending. You couldn't, of course, if there were two guys at the opposite ends of the cable that wanted to send at the same instant, you couldn't tell. But pretty soon, in fact, within 10 microseconds or so, this guy's signal would get to you, and then you could actually see it, which was not true for the packet radio system. So the philosophy of Ethernet was, you didn't send if you saw that somebody else was already sending. And furthermore, if you got a collision, if you and the other guy sent, because you were too far apart to know, as soon as you detected the collision, you would quit. So that means that the cost of collisions were quite a bit less frequent because you didn't send if somebody else was already sending and you could see it. And if you did get a collision, you could stop it very cheaply instead of sending a whole packet before you discovered that was being wasted because of the collision. So that means that properly used and with decent sized packets, you could get utilizations in the low 90% out of Ethernet, whereas the best you could do with a low out was about 35%. So that was cool. Although this collision thing caused problems later, because being engineers, it seemed perfectly reasonable to us to call this collisions. But when Ethernet became productized and was competing against the IBM token ring in the early and mid-80s, apparently the IBM marketers would go to the bankers and they would say, "You guys are thinking about installing a local area network, right?" And that was a trendy thing to do in the mid-80s. "Yeah, we're doing that." "And you're probably considering both token ring and Ethernet." "Yeah, we are." "Do you realize that on the Ethernet, the packets containing your valuable dollars are going to collide with other packets? You really want your dollars to be colliding with other people's dollars?" "No, very bad." "Well, that doesn't happen with token ring, so it's definitely better." So if they called it coordination instead of collision, it would have been much better from a marketing point of view. But we weren't sophisticated enough to think of that. Anyway, here it is. It ran at 3 megabits per second. Oh, and then the other idea behind Ethernet that many of you probably know is this really cool idea of exponential backoff, which is if you do get a collision, then you wait for some random length of time and try again. And if you get another collision, you double the interval in which you choose the random number. And you keep doing that. So the result is that the load you offer goes down by a factor of 2 every time you get a collision. And this is essentially a way for you to adapt to the aggregate load in the system. You find out what the load is because you keep backing off until the system can accommodate your needs. And it worked reasonably well. And today's Ethernet still has this, although it's never used today. Because today, Ethernet is all... The Ethernet port that you have in your office is wired to a switch, not to anything that looks like an Ether. The switch is store and forward, and traffic on the switch is controlled by some start-stop protocol. And none of this collision stuff is actually used, even though it's still implemented in all of the interfaces. And there are several reasons for that. The most important one is that as the Ethernet gets... The thing about the collision stuff is that the minimum packet length has to be longer than the round trip time on the network, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to detect the collision. You'd be sending a packet, you'd send the whole packet before you saw the other guy, and you wouldn't know whether it had collided or not. So as the thing gets faster, the minimum, if you want to keep the network diameter the same, as the thing gets faster, the minimum packet length increases. Well, having the minimum packet length increase is a no-no, because that's incompatible. So the result is that the acceptable diameter shrinks. So for a 10 megabit Ethernet, the acceptable diameter was a kilometer or so, and for 100 megabit Ethernet, it was 100 meters, and for 10 megabit Ethernet, it's only 10 meters, and that's not enough. Plus, if you go to the switch scheme, of course, you can get much more aggregate bandwidth because you don't have to share the thing among all the users. So today's Ethernet doesn't actually use any of this wonderful stuff that we thought up in 1973, even though it's still called Ethernet and it's all still implemented. it takes up this tiny little corner of silicon. There were repeaters, so you didn't have to use only one piece of coax. You could have several pieces of coax all plugged into a little piece of electronics that just repeats the signal from one to another, so it still behaves like an ether. We didn't have switches in those days because they were too expensive to implement, and in fact, it never occurred to anyone that it was possible to do switching on the Ethernet until the mid-80s when some clever people at DEC figured this out, because the way switching works in the ARPANET and the Internet, you look at the address and it basically tells you in a somewhat complicated way which switches the packet should go through to get from where it starts out to where it's supposed to go. The Ethernet, the addressing is completely flat. And there's no mechanism for finding out where anybody is. So how could switching possibly work? So the brilliant insight that the DEC guys had was that the switch fabric can learn where everyone is by saying, if you don't know it, you broadcast. But after you've seen the thing, you know if you see a packet coming in on this wire, then you know that source address is out that port. And that's how Ethernet switching works. It learns the topology in a completely incremental way. And it never entered into anyone's head in the early 70s that would even be possible. So that's Ethernet. Laser printers, this was the marriage of xerography and computing. It was one of the things actually that Park did from the very beginning, because Gary Starkweather came out, who was an optics guy, came out to Park from the Xerox labs in Rochester, New York, and built the optics and electromechanical part of laser printing. And
was Starkweather actually unappreciated at Rochester?
Yes, they didn't like him. They thought he was crazy, in fact. Here's a picture, and you can actually see the laser beam. It's this red line. So in those days, the way it was implemented was that the beam came out of the laser and it hit a multifaceted spinning mirror. And as it was bouncing off one facet of the mirror, the spinning caused the reflected beam to scan across the drum. And then you'd get to the next facet and it would scan again. By that time, of course, the drum had rotated a little bit. And that was how it scanned its way across. Nowadays, it's done in other ways. So Gary built the electromechanical. He adapted the copier and built the optics. And then Ron Ryder and I designed, and Ron built the actual electronics to drive the thing, which was extremely non-trivial. Because here's the copier ran at a page a second. And there was no way to slow it down, because it was a more or less standard Xerox copier, and they were extremely delicate and fragile objects. You couldn't mess with them very much, or they would stop working entirely. So you had to keep up. And furthermore, Gary had decided that it was going to be high resolution, 500 dots per inch, which turned out, in retrospect, to be a big mistake, because the toner wasn't actually good enough for that. So we would have been just as well off with a 300 dot per inch engine, which is what we switched to later. But the original one was 500 dots per inch. So that means 25 million pixels have to be supplied in 1 second. And with the technology of 1973, that was not so easy. In fact, it took a rack of hardware that was about three times the size of an Alto to actually do this, and it couldn't do arbitrary images. It could only do characters of a fairly sophisticated kind. So if you wanted to do images on the original laser printers, you had to find some way to draw them using characters. So basically, you could only do images with rectangular lines, horizontal and vertical lines. And that was the best we could do. Later on, we had slower printers that you could, where you could construct the whole bitmap on the fly. But this is the way this one was done. So there was the so-called slot, the scanning laser output terminal, which was the actual electromechanical optical part of the thing. There was this so-called research character generator, which I just described. It was driven by an Alto, which fed it the characters in the right order, figured out what the right order was, and all that complicated stuff. And then you talk to it over Ethernet. So you could sit in your office and say, I want to print this document, and magically it would go to the printer, and you could walk over there. And there usually wasn't much of a queue, so you could pick up your output right away. It was great. Later on, as I say, we built another one called the Dover, which ran on the same copier engine, but it was only 300 dpi, and it had a much cleverer, less capable, much cleverer piece of electronics driving it. We built about 100 of those and gave a number of them away to universities and things. And Xerox understood computer printing, sort of, and they built a multi-billion dollar business on it, which was more than enough to pay for what they spent on the computing part of PAR, even with a reasonable discount. I mean, if you have a research lab, you should expect to make many times what you put into it, because the risk is so high. And they did. So that was cool. This was the part of what we did that basically paid for the whole thing. And that's very often what happens with research labs. For example, after I left Xerox, I went to a DEC lab in Palo Alto, which ran for I was there for a little more than 10 years. And we built a number of very interesting things, none of which, for a variety of reasons, ever turned into a successful product. It looked like the whole thing was a bust, and $150 million that DEC had spent on it over 10 or 12 years was going to go down the drain. But then it turned out CERC built AltaVista, which was the first search engine. And the company was successful in selling it at the height of the internet bubble for $2.5 billion. So that was enough to pay for CERC several times over. But it's very hard to predict In fact, in this case, even more difficult because the basic software that was used to do the indexing for AltaVista was originally built for an entirely different purpose. It was built to support Mary Claire Van Loon's corpus lexicography project, the idea of which was that we cut a deal with Oxford University Press. They sent us four lexicographers and a corpus of several hundred million words of text. And we built the software so that these guys could search it and use it as a tool for building the next version of some Oxford University Press dictionary. And nobody had the faintest idea what this was going to be good for. But we thought it was cool, and so we did it. And what it turned out to be good for was AltaVista. This is a somewhat oversimplified story, but so
question from Microsoft?
Is true. Excuse me? Question from Microsoft, yes.
Yeah, so you mentioned the notion of Xerox making a return on the investment from the research. Was that ever something that was prevalent in your minds, or
no, absolutely
were
not.
Researchers just kind of full bore ahead about the
That's
opposite
right.
future?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we were confident that the stuff would be so great that they'd be able to make lots of money. And indeed, it was great, and lots of people did make lots of money. And we'll talk a little bit about why Xerox didn't make nearly as much as they should have.
Did that influence part of the research agenda? Like productization of, future productization of technology? Or was it more like, this is neat, this is the future, let's go with it?
No, in many cases it did, actually. For example, the research character generator that I just described was actually the prototype for the electronics that was used to run the 9700 computer printer, which was the core of Xerox's very successful computer printing business. And there were a number of other examples like that. But we were not at all uncomfortable about doing stuff that had some fairly direct relevance to products. On the other hand, we tried very hard not to turn into product developers.
Now, why didn't Xerox just take the Altima and just
We will talk about that. That's a very good question, and we will talk about that. So I'm going to just kind of zip through the software that we did. So we'll have plenty of time to talk about things like that. So we had to do programming languages. We had to do an operating system, and we had to do programming languages. And the main problem that we confronted in this space was we had to live with a tenth of a MIP. That was about how much you got out of an Alto if the display was turned on. And 128 kilobytes of RAM, that was much worse, and at most 5 megabytes of disk. So the philosophy of the operating system was more like a collection of library packages than an operating system. So when you booted the machine up, you got this more or less full-fledged, type of command line kind of operating system. But when you launched an application, it could discard as much of the operating system as it wanted. And it could take those packages and load them back into its own overlay system if it felt that it needed those functions, or if it didn't need them, it could just forget about it. So you could basically take over the whole machine, and many applications did that. Most of the original Alto programming was done in BCPL. BCPL was a language that was the ancestor of C. In fact, C was made from BCPL basically by making the minimal changes necessary to make it work on a byte address machine. BCPL had the attitude that an integer and a pointer were the same size, and then if you added one to a pointer, you would get a pointer to the next integer. And that's not true on a byte address machine, so you got to do something about that, and that's what C did. And they added curly braces and a few other things like that that are not so important. So you can think of BCPL as being more or less equivalent to at least early versions of C. And we did most of the original Alto programming in BCPL. That was pretty successful. We didn't do any programming in assembly language. We did do some programming in microcode. Later, we had a type language that grew out of Klaus Wirth's Pascal called Mesa. Then there was Smalltalk. So that was programming languages. We built a whole bunch of servers. We did networking. Not only did we do the Ethernet, but since we also had a connection to the ARPANET, and we had phone lines connecting us to other Xerox sites that had their own Ethernets, we needed an internet. And we developed an internet. The original idea is more or less in parallel with the original proposals by Cerf and Kahn for the public internet. But our implementation actually preceded theirs. And for some reason that I've never quite been able to fathom, we decided that we shouldn't talk about our implementation. So Metcalf and John Schock and Dave Boggs and Ed Taft, the people who built that, never really got credit for it. What they did get to do was they could go to Vint Cerf's internet design seminar at Stanford. And they weren't allowed to talk about PUP. PUP stood for Park Universal Packet. That was our internet standard format. And in some respects, it was grossly inferior to the internet. For example, we had an 8-bit network number instead of a 32-bit network number. So that would have pretty much been a disaster for the internet. Or it was beyond our wildest dreams that we would ever use, ever have 256 networks. In fact, there's a little story about that I'll tell in a minute. But anyway, the networking guys would go to Vint's seminar, and they weren't allowed to talk about PUP, but they could ask questions. And after a while, they'd asked enough questions that Vint looked at one of them and said, "You've done this before, haven't you?" So the story about the PUP network numbers was, it was an 8-bit field in the packet, but nobody, we only had 3 networks, for Christ's sake. So the code that actually ran on the Alto was compiled with a 32-entry table. That's far more networks than we'd ever have. Then everybody kind of forgot that had been done. And more Altos were built, and more sites had them, and there were more and more Ethernets, and more of this and that. And then one day, about 2 weeks before we were scheduled to get a visit from the president of Xerox, the network stopped working. Investigation revealed that someone had connected up the 33rd network. And there was no bounds checking on this table. So it just went off the end of the table and smashed some other vitally important cell. And everything would come down in flames. And because this code was actually compiled into a whole bunch of executables that were distributed on 1,000 Altos scattered around the company, the only thing we could do was to decommission 4 or 5 networks until after the presidential visit was over. And then, of course, it was possible to expand the size of the table and yada yada. But this is a great example of a success disaster. Because, as I say, at the time that these decisions were taken, nobody ever dreamt that there would be 30 networks. Never mind the billion that we have today. Okay, so that was networking. We did printing. We already talked about that. We built a file system. We had grand plans to build a fancy transactional file system, which we actually did eventually implement, but it took much longer than we thought. So we had an interim file system, which lasted, I believe, for 12 years, which was done on the Alto by adapting the file system that I originally wrote for the Alto a fair amount. And then we did email. We started out with vanilla ARPANET email on the 10X system, our centralized time-sharing system. But then later we built Grapevine, which was the first, I believe, the first real distributed email server system.
Can I ask a question about printing? Was the need for interpress obvious? And
no, that was much later.
Okay.
What did happen, originally we just had ears, and you wouldn't really recognize the way that ears was done as being a printing, a page description language in the modern sense, because remember, ears could only print characters. So there were no issues about images.
Got
furthermore,
it.
We didn't have any very sophisticated notion of font management. So you actually had to incorporate the bitmaps for any fonts that you wanted to use in the document that you sent to the printer. The printer had no concept of font management. And 2 or 3 years later, all of it seemed quite unsatisfactory. And William Newman and Bob Sproul designed a thing called Press, which was recognizably a page description language, and it did its own font management, et cetera, et cetera. And that was used pretty heavily throughout the whole Alto system for quite a few years. And then in the early 80s, we needed something that was more sophisticated than that, and so Bob Sproul and I, with a lot of consulting from John Warnock, designed Interpress, which you can think of as the predecessor to PostScript. Or maybe you should think of it as the predecessor to PDF, because it wasn't quite as wild and free as PostScript. And Warnock didn't actually like that, because we put a lot of effort in Interpress into controlling the flexibility of the programming language, with the idea that the printer should be able to say, "I only want to print pages 12 through 14, and it shouldn't have to work its way through pages 1 through 11 before it could do that successfully. And PostScript, that's not the case, because you can do all kinds of complicated stuff on pages 1 through 11 that affect what happens on page 12. And Warnock thought this was great. And so when he did PostScript, he took out all these features. And he thought that they were actually not only unnecessary, but bad. And Adobe has been working for the last 20 years to put some of them back in. What he did was probably the right thing for the when they got started. I was a little pissed because I designed that part of Enterprise. And then Warnock arrogantly told me 3 or 4 years later that, well, you know, you could do that all with comment conventions, which is absolutely not true. And people have had a lot of trouble with PostScript because of that.
So, by the way, you skipped remote procedure call.
I guess I did. Yeah, I don't have anything about that. But yeah, later in the, towards the end of the 70s, we did this remote procedure call thing, which Ed Lazaska worked on.
But Grapevine was an RPC system, right?
It was? I don't know. Was it? Are you sure?
No.
I don't think it was. I don't think it was. That was all a bit later. User interfaces, Windows. Smalltalk pioneered overlapping Windows. We didn't have that on the rest of the Alto system because Smalltalk was willing to pay for a whole bitmap. They took the hit up front. And they got it back in other ways, and they sacrificed a lot of speed in order to do it. The other Alto systems used tiled windows. So here's the Smalltalk picture. And of course, Smalltalk is much more than a window system. They not only pioneered overlapping windows and bitblit, but they also had an integrated edit debugging system and a full-blown object-oriented language. All that's been enormously influential on many aspects of computing. But it was not my thing. It was Alan Kay's thing. I kibitzed on it a fair amount, but I wasn't deeply involved with it. If you want to know about that, you should get Alan to come.
So question from UDub.
Excuse me?
Question from UDub. Would you say that NLS actually was the one that pioneered overlapping boxes? Didn't they pioneer that concept?
No, it wasn't that important for them, I think. It was pretty fundamental for Smalltalk. They did have some elements of that, but I don't think it was that important in NLS. And I'm quite hazy, actually, about exactly what you could and what you couldn't do. So Bravo, I did work on. In fact, it was a couple of my ideas that got Bravo started. It was the first what you see is what you get editor, and it was a prototype for Microsoft Word. In fact, Charles Simony left Xerox and went to Microsoft and brought many of those ideas with him. And Microsoft Word still uses some of the data structures that we designed in 1973. Bravo started out as a screen editor, as a fixed font screen editor, but subsequently we added fonts and layout and high quality printing and styles and most of the things that you recognize in the sort of as the sort of basic features of a modern high end word processor. An interesting aspect of the Bravo story is that we made a deliberate decision that we wouldn't work on the user interface, not because we didn't think it was important, but because we thought it was hard and we just didn't have the resources. So we decided to focus all of our attention on the implementation issues, and we kind of kludged up the user interface. And then we were very, very fortunate that Larry Testa and Tim Mott came along. Xerox had bought a textbook company called GIN, and these guys had the idea that they would build an editing system that would be very well suited to the needs of the GIN and company editors. And so they actually went to GIN and spent several weeks there to try to learn what it is that editors actually do. It's extremely hard to learn what people actually do. You cannot find it out by asking them, because they are not paid to know, to be able to articulate what they do. They're paid to do it. And if you want to know what they do, you have to watch. There's no other way. Many people have learned this by bitter experience. But anyway, Tesla and Mott did that, and then they came back and they decided that they would build a system using the implementation guts of Bravo, and that they would put all their energy into the user interface. And that was very successful, and they actually designed the first modeless, sort of modern user interface. They didn't have icons, but they did have the notion of modeless editing. Select and then give the command, and you never get... They didn't even have dialog boxes or wizards or any of that nonsense. They had a pretty pure modeless system. And subsequently, that was backported to Bravo.
Question?
Yes.
Given that one of Park's goals was to design the office environment of the future, why was it that there weren't more user studies conducted, you know, with office workers and observing office workers in order to get that kind of raw data?
There was quite a bit of that done, actually. It was done in SSL, not in CSL.
Okay.
It would probably have been better if more of it had been done, but it's just incredibly hard. One of the things the SSL guys did late in the 70s, I think around 1977, they actually went and studied the operation of the Xerox Santa Clara branch sales office. And their original idea was that they would go there and spend a few weeks and understand the sales office. And after they'd been there for a couple weeks, they realized that this was hopelessly ambitious. And they cut their goals way back, and they spent about 6 months, at the end of which they understood pretty well how the office processed expense reports. Now, you laugh, but we could not do better today. Yeah. This stuff is hard. You will not know how hard it is unless you try it. And expense reports are complicated. And, you know, you can go there, and they'll have a book that says how it's done. And the procedures described in the book reasonably clearly will account for, indeed, 90% of the expense reports. That will account for about 10% of the time that's spent by the people who process expense reports. 90% of the time is spent on 10% of the reports. And all kinds of weird things happen. And there are all kinds of processes that are not well documented, and that's just the way things are in real life. So these guys did do those studies, and then they designed a system called Office Talk, the goal of which was to make it, was to facilitate the automation of these processes. And I think they learned a fair number of things, but I don't think they were ever really successful in deploying it. It's really hard. And even today, the word for this stuff today is workflow, and we don't do it very well with today's systems, which are, of course, from a raw capability point of view, much,
so,
much better.
Butler, we usually take a break at about this time, but
okay.
I'd like to actually break this in an organic way.
Okay, well, let me
if you could round out the technology part or wherever seems natural.
All right, I think that'll be good. We can just zip along here. So we talked about Windows. Another important aspect of these interfaces was what I've been called views. So you've got to compute what goes onto the screen. So we did that in a variety of ways. Here's the Smalltalk browser interface, which has been copied many times. The idea here is that you have essentially you're seeing successive levels of a tree. So here's the top level, and then this is one of these guys. I guess collections.sequence is here, and this is the ordered collection case of it, and so on. So you're going down one path of the tree towards the leaves. And this is a metaphor that many people have used subsequently. This is the Laurel email client header pane. This is one-third of what you see in Laurel. And many, many people have copied this. The idea is not very profound, but I think it was done this way for the first time in Laurel. Here's the full-blown Laurel screen. This was Laurel and Grapevine were a distributed email system. The server part, there were multiple servers. It implemented both a name space for the users and storage for their mailboxes, and it pioneered the idea that came to be known as eventual consistencies for maintaining a replicated database in a fairly casual sort of way without any centralization. And the client had this three-pane window scheme where you had the headers here. We saw a bigger version of that on the previous slide. And here's the message that you're reading, and here's the message that you're composing. And of course, people don't quite do it this way anymore, but Laurel was a very successful system. It was the first system that we built in CSL with the goal of not needing to have a manual. So a lot of work did go into the Laurel UI design, and it was hard. It looks very simple, but probably a man-year and a half of effort went into designing it. And that's very typical for user interfaces. And the third aspect of user interfaces is menus. William Newman's markup system had, I believe, the world's first pop-up menus. Here's the pop-up menu right in here. So you're seeing these are the names of some files that you've accessed recently. These are all the tools. And down here are the fonts. So you could pop this up, and then you could select a tool or select a font or whatever. This was a bitmap editing program, much like today's paint programs. Displaying things. So we had bitmaps, as in today that's done with Photoshop and paint. That was done by markup. And we had object graphics, which is the kind of thing that McGraw brought to masses in 1984, and today is represented by Illustrator, which of course, Adobe Illustrator, which of course is a much more sophisticated program. We had a font editor. We had to design all our own fonts for the printers and for the screen. And all those screen fonts were designed by turning on individual bits one by one and looking at how it looked. The printer fonts were actually generated automatically. And then Dan Ingalls and the Smalltalk group invented Bitlet as the primitive for manipulating rectangular chunks of bitmap. And that was used for a wide variety of things to make Alto bitmaps. Now here's markup. This was the pure bitmap editor. The charm of it was you could do completely arbitrary images, but of course you had to live with the relatively low resolutions, about, I don't know, 70 dots per inch or something like that, of the Alto screen. And as I mentioned, it had the pop-up menu. Here's an example of the kind of picture that you could somewhat painfully draw in markup. I think this is, I don't know what that is. Then we had Draw, which was our spline editing program. I'm sure all of you have used programs like this today. This was really cool in 1974, because you couldn't make such beautiful pictures on computers before this. For logic drawings, we had a very specialized editor called SIL, and here's an example of a logic drawing that was done in SIL. Somewhat to people's surprise, for a lot of just general purpose drawing that had nothing to do with hardware design, people preferred SIL if you didn't want beautiful curves and stuff. It was fast, and it could handle very complex images gracefully. Later on, we built a system called Cedar, which had full-blown tiling windows. It ran on the successor hardware to the Alto, and you could do stuff that's very familiar to you from today's Windows systems in Cedar. Very much unlike the Alto, where, as I said, you could only do one thing at a time. So here's a summary of the application story, and this is going to be the place for the break. We worked on writing, drawing, and email, roughly speaking, for applications. And then, as I said, Smalltalk was a whole separate enterprise. And for writing, we had Bravo, which evolved into Microsoft Word. And there were the two threads there. One was the implementation technique that actually made it possible to do WYSIWYG editing. And the other was the user interface ideas that came from Gypsy. We did drawing, several different flavors of it. Markup evolved into the paint programs of the 80s and today. Draw evolved into MacDraw and Illustrator and the graphics that you have in PowerPoint and things like that. And SIL evolved into CAD programs. And then we had email, we had Laurel, and which evolved into programs like MH and then later into Eudora and Outlook and so forth. And all those things have user interfaces that are basically copied. Maybe even in some cases they were invented independently, but they certainly look as though they were copied from Laurel. And that's probably a good place to stop for the break. Okay, so to sum all this up, what was the Alto system like? Well, it was just like today's personal computing world.
It was
better. Writing, drawing, music eventually, I didn't talk about that, but we did do a bunch of music stuff. Networks, printing, email. You didn't have the web or search engines. You didn't have spreadsheets. You didn't have integration. And things were a lot slower and smaller. You could do, in Bravo, you could do 20-page or 30-page documents. You couldn't. Nowadays, in Word, you can routinely handle a 1,000-page book, and it works pretty well. I do it all the time. But
Butler, comment from Washington?
Excuse me? Yes.
Comment from Washington. You left out multiplayer distributed games from the top list.
Yeah, we did that, too. I was never particularly interested in that, but we multiplayer distributed games, I believe, were invented.
Maze War was the greatest.
And then there was some Star Trek-flavored game, right?
Yep. It was called Star Trek.
It was called Star Trek, right. That was one of Rick Rashid's things.
I know, seriously.
Which is done at Rochester, because we had a program we gave a bunch of Altos to four or five universities. Most of them were the usual suspects, MIT, Stanford, Carnegie, but Xerox headquarters was in Rochester. So we gave a bunch to the University of Rochester. So that kind of gives you the flavor of it. I mean, these are the things that were missing. But other than that, it had the same feel as today's computing systems, personal computing systems on your desk. And that's a pretty good summary of what it was like qualitatively. So then, how'd it go? What about looking outside of the research lab? Well, in 1976, we did a huge show and tell. Xerox was holding a company-wide conference in Boca Raton, Florida, to which the top 100 or so executives in the company were invited. And they were doing a lot of things at this conference, but one of the things was we had a big room and we brought 30 or 40 Altos and several printers and Ethernets and all the software that we've been talking about. And we showed it off. And we thought it went incredibly well, but it was pretty clear a few weeks or months later that although it appeared that the wives of the executives got it pretty well, the executives didn't get it. And there's an amusing story from that conference that we brought all this stuff and we plunked it down in this meeting hall, and it way overloaded the air conditioner, which wasn't designed to handle all these Altos and heat generating xerographic printers and one thing and another. And so it got hot enough in there that A, it was very uncomfortable, and B, the equipment started to malfunction. So the guy who was organizing all this was named John Ellenby, and he's a guy with a lot of initiative. So he went off to Eastern Airlines in Miami and got one of the gadgets that they use to cool 747s when they're on the ground and the main power system's not running. And he brought that over and hooked it up to the input vents of the building's air conditioning system. And now instead of it being 85 or 90 in there, it was 50. So it definitely solved that problem.
So is that the show at which Sproul and Boggs made snow?
Probably, yes. Probably. So this did have a result, I think. Xerox started a thing called the System Development Division, which was chartered to bring the Office of the Future, to make the Office of the Future into a product.
Question?
Yes.
Here at Microsoft, we're never really far away from our ship date, even in research. When you were developing this stuff, in your mind, when did you think it would actually get to the customer?
Well, we
I mean, $12,000 was unreasonable.
We thought it would take about 10 years.
About 10 years.
And we were right. It did take about 10 years.
It just wasn't you bringing it to the customer.
Well, we never thought that we would bring it.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Xerox shipped something. That we're going to get to that in just a minute.
Okay, thank you.
It took about 10 years for Xerox to ship a system that substantially exceeded everything that we'd done in research. And we're just going to get, that was the star office system. So they started the System Development Division, and it did two things. One of the things it did was to develop the star office system, which we're going to talk about in just a minute. That was a Xerox product that came out in 1981. And the other thing they did was, they, in order to sort of get their toe into the water, they marketed on a very limited basis to a very select group of customers. They marketed Alto systems. And for example, we sold, four or five Altos and a Dover printer to the Carter White House. And they were used routinely for internal document preparation. And this story may be apocryphal, but it's a great story. When Reagan got elected, the Republicans came in and they looked at this Alto stuff and they couldn't understand it. And they said, get this Democratic shit out of here. but the bureaucratic wheels turned very slowly, and you know, it took several months to actually get it out. And in the interim, they were still using it to prepare the president's schedule and things like that. And they could print Reagan's schedule in 16-point type, and he really liked that. Because his eyesight wasn't that good, he was a little old. And so he said, I want more of this. So in the end, they ordered some more Altos instead of getting rid of the Democratic stuff. It opened up the geriatric market, which I think still hasn't really been exploited. So quite a few interesting things were learned as a result of this. And many of the Alto systems were refined quite a bit as part of this experimental thing. But the star development took place more or less independently. And let's see, is that what we're going to get to next? So here's a summary of what Xerox did with the Alto. They did electronic printing. We talked about that. I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a minute. And they made lots of money on high-end electronic printing. And the other thing they did was they built the star system, which was a really great system that was a commercial failure. So there's this famous quote from Gordon Moore that it's, the reason that the computer industry runs on startups is that it's much easier to persuade a venture capitalist to give you money than it is to persuade the management of a large successful company to try something new. Well, that was not true with Xerox. They did try two new things. They tried totally scanner-based laser electronic printing, which was a big success at the high end, and they tried the star system, which was not a success, but they tried. So the problem was not what Gordon says. It was not that we couldn't get them to try it. So printing. Here's a picture of, the top picture is a picture of the 9700 printer. This was built on a Xerox copier. Xerox had a lot of trouble developing copiers. There was a lot of black art in it, but it was not really an option to develop a new printing engine for the computer printing. They had to use an engine that already existed. And since they wanted to do high-end computer printing, it had to be fast, so they used the Xerox 9200 copier, which was the 2-page-a-second top-of-the-line Xerox copier. The upside of that was it had good paper handling and it was sheet-fed. But the downside of it was that it turned out that the 9200 used a photoreceptor that was sensitive to blue light. Didn't make that much difference for copiers. You know, you get the flash lamp to make any frequencies you want. But blue lasers were a black art in the late 70s. They were helium-selenium lasers, I think. No, helium-cadmium lasers. And they just barely worked. And the blue laser was a huge problem, not one that I was interested in. But the 9700 had a character generator that drove it that was based on the research character generator that Ron Ryder and I designed and that Ron built at Park in the mid-70s. Its competition was a printer from IBM. IBM had much better electromechanical engineering than Xerox, and they needed it. They built they weren't really seriously in the copier business, and they built but of course they were very seriously in the computer printing business, and they built a from scratch laser printing engine. And they decided, this is a very interesting story. They decided that it was very important for it to be compatible with the way people were doing their computer printing before. And the way people used to do computer printing was with fanfold paper. You had a box of paper that folded up like this, and you loaded it into the printer, and then the printer went and printed the lines on the paper. And they decided that the laser printer was going to do that. I think they didn't quite grasp the implications of this. It turned out there are two bad implications. One of them is a little bit subtle, which is the way xerography works, you have a photoreceptor, which is typically deposited on a drum, and you shine light on it, and that causes it to become charged in certain places, and then you sprinkle the ink, which is called toner, on there, and it sticks to the places that are charged. And then here's the photoreceptor and here's the paper. You bring it along like this, and the paper is charged the other way, and so it grabs the ink off the drum, and it's sticking to the paper by the electrostatic charge. And then it travels some distance, and it goes through a fuser, which heats it up and essentially melts the toner into the paper, because the electrostatic charge is not, it's not hanging on that tight. So in between the place where it picks up the ink and the place where it gets fused, it's only the electrostatic charge that's holding it in place. Well, computer printers have the property, people expect that you can stop between pages. That was just a rule. That means that in this fanfold printer, the paper is traveling along at 30 inches per second. And in the interpage gap, which is about 1 inch, you have to be able to decelerate from 30 inches per second to zero and then start up again. The question is, what happens to the toner that is hanging on by electrostatic force when you do this? The answer is, it gets jiggled. And that ruined the beautiful, sharp image. And that's a disaster. What are you going to do about that? Well, IBM has the world's best electromechanical engineers, and they figured out a solution, which involved a complicated system of tension arms to slow the paper down in exactly the right way. And tension arms weren't enough. There was elaborate servo control on the tension arms. In addition to that, there were custom-designed coil springs on the end of the arms so that everything was handled gently enough that the toner wouldn't get shaken off. So that was the first problem with the apparently innocent decision to use fanfold paper. Now, the second problem was much more severe and also much more obvious in retrospect. And I'll tell you what the result of it was. It was that the throughput of these things turned out to be about two-thirds, half to two-thirds of what they expected. So why do you suppose that was?
How do they keep the paper from burning on the user?
That was complicated, too, but that was a less difficult problem. There's a whole issue, maybe two whole issues, of the IBM R&D journal that explain the wonders of the engineering of this computer printer. So you can look, it's probably on the web, you can look it up.
One way to do it would be to...
But the question is, why was the throughput only two-thirds of what was expected?
Because you have to rip it apart.
No, they have wonderful automatic ripper gadgets. And they already had those for the chain printers, and so that was okay. I mean, they had to engineer them a bit, but that was okay. They had that under control. No, the problem's at the other end.
Oh. The fuse has to be right next to the other one.
No, it was actually several feet away. The problem is, Fanfill paper comes in a box.
Yeah.
Oh. And what you do is, when you use up one box, you take another box, you pull the paper out of the box, and you stick it into the printer's paper feed mechanism. Well, the paper feed mechanism on this thing was rather elaborate, because there were all these tension arms and, you know, a complicated path past the image. On a chain printer, it's pretty simple. You just move the paper past the chain, and the hammers are going whap, whap, whap in a horizontal line, and that's about it. But here, not so. The paper is quite complex, and it goes through this hot fuser and past this delicate drum and one thing and another. So rethreading the paper path is out of the question. So what you have to do, having carefully threaded it once, which takes many minutes, when you use up one box, you have to splice the beginning of the next box onto the end of the previous box of paper. They had a carefully designed vacuum-assisted splicing station to help out with this, but the operator had to do it. Well, it turns out at 30 inches a second, it takes about 10 minutes to go through a box. So every 10 minutes, the bell rings, and the operator has to scurry over and splice in the next box. Well, the operator doesn't do that full time. The operator is doing other things too. So quite often when the bell rings, the operator is not right there. Well, now the machine is sitting there, not producing any output. And it's not going to produce any output until you splice in the next box. So this...
bigger boxes.
No, because the whole point was to be compatible. Use bigger boxes, now they're too heavy and people can't lift them, and all the forms that people, that the customers have been procuring for 20 years don't work anymore, and no, it'd be a disaster. The solution to this problem that people use who are not doing computer printing but are doing real live paper printing, they use what's called web feeding. They have giant rolls of paper. It's a completely different approach, but it completely wrecked the goal of compatibility. So the consequence of this apparently innocent decision to be compatible and use fanfold paper was that the system only performed about two-thirds as well as it should have done. And it's pretty clear that nobody realized this until it was far too late to change the decision. So I think that's a fairly interesting story in the... when you're designing things like this, you always have to think about the fact that they're existing in a fairly complex ecosystem. And you only have control of some parts of that ecosystem. And in this case, once they've taken the basic decision to use fanfold paper, it's very difficult to see what they could have done to make things better. Now, the 9200, 9700 didn't have this problem because it had cut sheet paper and it had two big input trays. So while the printer was printing the 1,000 or 1,500, two or three reams that were in one of the input trays, the operator had plenty of time to load the other input, which wasn't involved at all. So they didn't have this problem at all. And I think that's kind of interesting. Then there were also low-end printers. The first one was built for the Star system, and here it is. Let's see. This is the actual printer, which was based on a low-end xerographic copier. This is the processor box, sort of like the box that a PC comes in. And this is just the control. Normal Star systems use this box, but then hooked up a fancy display. But for the printer, you didn't need a fancy display, so they had this VT100, a flavored display. And for this printer, Park developed and SDD implemented an Interpress, which you can think of as the predecessor to PostScript. So the 9700 was very successful. The low-end printer was not very successful because it was sold as part of the Star system, and the Star system was not very successful for reasons that we are now about to get to. So the other thing that SDD...
Where did CAN come from in the print engine business? It was like
low end.
83 or something?
The laser writer, the Apple laser writer shipped at the beginning of 1985, and right. I think HP was also getting its engines from CAN, and I think that might have been a little bit earlier,
yep.
But roughly the same time.
Wasn't DEC the first one to OEM, though?
DEC OEM'd from Xerox, and that was not a successful product.
Okay.
Because the Xerox printer wasn't very good, and the only thing it really had going for it was Interpress. But of course, DEC couldn't generate Interpress. That was all wrapped up with the Star system.
What was special about Canon's engine technology compared to the smaller Xerox engines?
Canon just did a much better job with... Xerox did a crappy job with low-end copiers because they didn't think there was any money in it. Now, big copiers were expensive to engineer. It was hard to compete with them in the big copier business, and the margins were better, and so they basically wrote off the small copier business. And the Japanese ate it up. And Canon was one of those Japanese suppliers that was very successful in the small copier business, and then they based their print engine on that. And Xerox basically didn't have a competitive low-end imaging engine. And that was it. And they didn't care, which was not smart, but that's what they did. That was the big mistake they made in computer printing. I guess maybe I should have said more about that. They were very successful in high-end computer printing. They basically wrote off the low-end on the grounds that there was no money there, just as they had written off the low-end copies. And of course, they were eaten alive from below. And the people who started out making low-end engines took away a lot of Xerox's business, and then actually moved up and made better and better engines and caused Xerox lots and lots of trouble. So this strategy of ignoring the low-end is not a good strategy. Okay, what about the Star? This was really the productization of a lot of the work that was done at Park. It was shipped in 1981, same year as the IBM PC. It ran on a processor called the Dandelion, which was actually quite similar to the Alto. And the prototype for the Dandelion was actually designed at Park and then handed off to SDD because we were looking at what they were doing. They were doing some other stuff, and it was pretty clear to us that it wouldn't succeed. So we actually diverted a couple of man years of our resources to design this processor for them, which they used very successfully. It was built on a programming language called Mesa, which had also been developed at Park and had been handed off to SDD, and an operating system called Pilot. It was very reliable, although somewhat slow. This was the system that the Star system was about 300,000 or 400,000 lines of code, which was a big system for 1980. And it was built by a team that was basically hired off the street. They hadn't been working together for a long time. And although the user interface design for Star was done extremely carefully and thoroughly, there was no real overall system design for the implementation. And it took about 4 or 5 years from the time they started it to the time they shipped. And I reviewed it about a year before they shipped it. And I said, any system that I know of that has those four properties that I just enunciated has a fifth property, which is that it doesn't work. And I predicted that they would not be able to ship it because it would not be reliable enough. And I was wrong. It was too slow and it was much too expensive, but it was reliable. And I actually think the reason for that was that they bought the Mesa religion of strongly type-checked interfaces. And it really worked for them. They were able to put this 400,000 line system together basically from scratch. They had to write every one of those lines. Using a team of people that were not accustomed to working with each other and without any real coherent system design, and they were able to make it work. And I think it was because they programmed it in Mesa. It's interesting. It was a highly integrated system. It had editing, spreadsheets, filing, printing, and some primitive database capabilities, and networking, of course. And there was nothing like it on the market for at least 10 years. It was roughly equivalent to what you got in 1995 if you bought Microsoft Windows and Microsoft Office, or the comparable thing on the Mac. It was slower than that, but it had basically, that was the level of functionality and integration that it had, probably better integration, actually. But it didn't sell. And the fundamental reason it didn't sell was that it was too expensive. And a secondary reason was that it was a closed system. And actually, it's interesting because Apple shipped, a year or two later, they shipped a system called the Lisa, which in many respects was the predecessor of the Mac. But it had these same properties that the Star had. It was a little bit cheaper, but it was more than 10 grand. And it was also a fairly closed system, and it didn't sell either. The irony of the whole story is that while the...
Closed system, not context means what?
Means that it was pretty difficult for an independent software supplier to write an app that would run on the Star system. Totally different from the PC. Somewhat similar, it was somewhat difficult to do that on the Mac too, and that was a serious problem with the Mac. That it was somewhat difficult to do app development for the Mac. But it was extremely hard on either the Lisa or the Star.
Is that done for intentional business reasons or simply for technical reasons
it was
that fell out of the design?
Done primarily, I think, for technical reasons. I don't think it was part of the business plan to say that third-party software would be evil. But they didn't understand that it was important. And so they said we can simplify life a lot if we don't cater for it. Because it means we don't have to document all this stuff and provide support and all those other things. And they decided that just wasn't important. And that was a major problem both of these systems had. The irony of it is that the researchers actually wanted the developers to do something much simpler and much more like the Alta. It could have been much cheaper and come to market sooner. But the SDD, the development organization, was run by engineers. And the engineers had a vision of the glorious system that they were going to build. And unlike many such visions, they actually succeeded in building the system that they dreamt of. And it was pretty solid. It was a little slow, but it was pretty solid. But it was a commercial disaster because it cost too much. And the reason it cost too much was that it had to have a lot of hardware behind it in order to achieve the goals that they set themselves. And as I say, I think the irony of it was that the researchers wanted them to set much less ambitious goals. And then they would have been able to do something that was much simpler, much more Alto-like, much less integrated. It still might not have succeeded, but I think it would have had a much better chance of success. It would have been much more like the Macintosh.
So, question.
Usually the model is that the researchers are the ivory tower people who want you to do all kinds of crazy stuff, and it's the product guys that bring them down to earth. In this case, it was the exact opposite.
Question from UW again?
Yes.
So it looks like the Star has a two-button mouse.
Yes. Why was there not three buttons? The PC had a two-button mouse for a long time until the tilt wheel came along. I think they decided that two buttons was about all that the customers could handle. And I remember seeing a tape of a usability study that was done for the Star. And you could see the screen. There was 10 or so lines of text, and part of the tape that I remembered that the subject had been asked to select three words on one of the lines. And it was clear that the subject was kind of uneasy about the whole situation, because you could see the cursor would go in a somewhat trembling way up to the first word. And then the button would go down, you could start seeing the characters turning black, she moves across. And round about the second word, kind of going like this, and then she does that, and bingo, she's down to the next line. So now, of course, all of this is black, and this is black. Now there's a very long pause, and now she starts to do this. I don't know what she did when she got to the beginning of the line. Maybe she panicked before that. So usability stuff is tough.
So did Tesla.
And with three buttons, it would have been worse. I don't know. I can't defend that. I didn't make that decision. They thought two buttons would be enough.
Did Tesla have any hand in the Star at all?
He was. Yeah, I think he did, actually. The main user interface design was done by Charles Irby and his cohorts. And they did a beautiful job. They really articulated the whole notion of icons and property sheets and all that stuff, which was subsequently copied by everybody. And as I say, they all succeeded in building a very highly integrated system with a tremendous amount of consistency in the user interface across the whole system.
Another question from UW.
Yes.
Last week we talked about DEC and some of their products, and about the same time frame they introduced the PDP 1123.
That was much earlier than the Star.
I was wondering if you happen to remember about what its cost was, and I'm just thinking hardware capabilities.
The PDP 11 was a very complex family, and of course the cost changed tremendously over time. Just viewed as a computer. And if you ask the question, would it make sense to buy this piece of hardware as a computer, given its raw computing and I/O capabilities for that price, it wasn't so unreasonable. But as an office system, it was just $20,000 was too much. At roughly the same time, a little bit earlier, actually, the Apple II was being very successful, and it cost $3,000. Of course, it was much crappier in many ways, but it's much easier to sell something for $3,000 to an office worker than for $20,000. You sell it for $20,000, basically only crazies are going to buy it. Whereas, you know, $3,000 you can wangle. So that was the deal.
Question from Microsoft. A little bit about the corporate culture at Xerox. Here at Microsoft, we have like different roles, like developers, testers, program managers. What was it like at Xerox?
Well, I didn't work in SDD, but I don't think it was a fairly small organization. They only had about 100 people, and I don't think it was nearly as articulated as that. I mean, I'm sure they had some sort of structure of management and testing and so forth, but I really don't know what the details of it were. But it was pretty successful. They produced this thing, more or less on schedule. It took a long time, but they had to do a lot of user interface design work, and they had to do a lot of hardware design work as well. I think the software was really not a bottleneck, and it was quite reliable. It was too slow, but that wasn't the thing that killed it, that it was too slow. The thing that killed it was that it was too expensive.
So was it the memory that was the major expense?
Where did the dollars go?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I kind of doubt that memory was the most expensive thing. There was a moderate amount of electronics. There was a non-trivial cost for the display. I had a hard disk. That was a major cost at the time. The Lisa, as I said, came out a year or two later, and the cost was not that much less. I think the Lisa was 10 grand and the Star was 16. And the Lisa was a year and a half later. And the screen wasn't as good and a couple other things. And Star had built-in networking, which the Lisa didn't have. And so you can see that it wasn't unreasonable in terms of the hardware engineering and the price that was being charged for that. It just was unsuitable for the market, as the Lisa was too.
Yeah, I have a question from San Diego.
Yeah?
Yeah, in an earlier part of your talk, you talked about at PARC that it was an environment of group thinking. And then on the slide that you have up currently...
No, I don't want to overstate that.
Yeah.
But there was a culture in CSL. And if you came in with a set of ideas that were radically at variance with that culture, you wouldn't be happy. And we did that deliberately. And you pay a price for doing that, but you get a benefit too. But, I mean, I don't want people to go running around saying this was all groupthink at PARC, because that's not an accurate representation of what it was like. I used that as a catchphrase.
That's fair. Where I was going is any manifestations of collaborative work that the technology that was being developed facilitated. Like, for example, you cited that there was 400,000 lines of code in that. The reason that the developers were able to do that is because it was built on Mesa. But I don't know what attributes of Mesa allowed or facilitated that. So I'm wondering if it was the beginnings of collaborative work among developers.
No, it didn't really have anything to do with that. The attributes of Mesa that were relevant were that you had to divide your program into modules.
Okay.
You had to have very clearly defined interfaces to the modules. And compatibility of the interfaces was checked fairly aggressively by the compiler. So a tremendous number of mistakes that you could make if you were programming in C, for example, were just ruled out by the programming system.
I don't want to violate my own rule. I do want to give you time to get out your points. But let me see if I understand to hear what the story is. Because of the work that was done at PARC in the 1970s, you had what in the jargon would be a first mover advantage. You were ahead of the other guys.
That's right.
You understood how this stuff integrated in a natural way that consumers would like. And if you had made the transition at the right price, then the world might have standardized on Xerox instead of Apple or IBM, and we would be living in a world where Xerox did in fact capture the, if there was a fumble, it was that first product.
That's my story.
Didn't bring the... All right, good. I just wanted to be sure I was processing.
That is definitely my story, that the fumble was that the product they built was a wonderful product, but it wasn't the right product for the time and the market. And I think, basically the reason for that was it was done by engineers, and they had a vision about what they wanted to do. They didn't... This is way overstated, but achieving their vision was much more important to them than succeeding with the product. and there were no powerful countervailing forces. I mean, Xerox as a corporation, of course, had all kinds of marketing, but none of that was applied here because the copier guys didn't believe in this and they didn't understand it, and they just didn't pay any attention. They gave STD a lot of money and said, go and do it. And STD had to do everything from the hardware design all the way through to the advertising. So the many of the things that they weren't particularly equipped to do.
The original legacy Xerox power structure didn't quite know what to do with the guys, and therefore for a long time they got to steer the boat without market input.
So another thing that they might have done is they might have micromanaged them. They definitely didn't do that. Mm-hmm. In fact, they went way over on the other side and basically turned them loose.
Anyway, I broke my own admonition, but thank you.
That's exactly right. And as I say, I think the ironic thing about it is that the researchers really wanted to do something much simpler and more conservative and cheaper and smaller. And it wasn't consistent with the vision that the product guys had. And I just want to reemphasize, they achieved their vision. Usually when you have a grand vision like that, it doesn't get achieved because there's so many things that can go wrong. This vision did get achieved. They actually built the thing. They sold 25,000 of them. But basically, they can only sell it to crazies, because only crazies were willing to pay $20,000 for a piece of office equipment.
Another
so
question.
That's pretty much the story of the Star. Other
Another
questions
question
about
from
it?
Microsoft?
Yes.
So you mentioned earlier that the Grip One is a very successful distributed email system.
Mm-hmm.
Why wasn't that commercialized? Was it because the Star office?
It was. The Star guys did commercialize Grip One. It was part of their system.
Okay. So I thought it was just a client side.
And they actually commercialized a lot of the protocols that we used under the name XNS. And many of those protocols were adopted by Novell. So they actually got rather wide distribution in the PC world for quite a long time. I don't know much about the details of that, but I believe that story is correct. It was a long time before the standard internet protocols really took over in the PC world. And a lot of the early stuff that was done was really copied from the stuff that the product versions of the Park work that were done by the STD guys. Other questions about this?
Yeah, so it seems like Apple did this. Apple did the Lisa, and it also did not succeed. And even you can say that Microsoft's first version of Office and Windows were not very successful. But they persisted and they continued building on it. Yet it seems like did Xerox try to continue this, or did they just kind of gave up?
They continued it in a sort of half-hearted way. But you have to realize. I think it's amazing that they pushed this as hard as they did, considering how countercultural it was for the Xerox Corporation. And after it didn't succeed, it's not really very surprising that they didn't say, okay, we've really got to make this work. It's surprising to me that they put as much into it as they did. Whereas for Apple and Microsoft, there was really no choice. It was part of the lifeblood. Where was Apple going? The Apple III was a bust. Where was Apple going to go if they didn't make the Lisa Macintosh path? It was just essential to make it work. And similarly with the Microsoft Office applications, that's a very interesting story there too, actually, because the Microsoft Word and Excel were not terribly successful. The word processor that dominated the PC world in the 1980s was WordPerfect, and the spreadsheet that dominated the PC world was Lotus 1-2-3. And Microsoft was very successful in the Mac, not too surprisingly, because the guy that ran was a technical head of the Microsoft application division was Charles Simoni, who came from Park and STD and had built Bravo. And so he really knew how to build an application for the Mac to take advantage of the Mac's graphics and so forth. That wasn't particularly an advantage for the PC. And also, it turns out Microsoft made a strategic error because at the time they were developing the first generation of applications, which were not Word and Excel, but a predecessor called Multiplan. Maybe there wasn't a corresponding word processor, I'm not sure. But the spreadsheet that we built first was called Multiplan. And we didn't actually believe in the IBM PC, even though we were doing the software for it. We thought that there would be, and this was way before my time, so it's really not right for me to say we, but Microsoft thought that the PC world would continue to be fragmented into a bunch of different architectures and operating systems. And that therefore, if you're going to make a success with the spreadsheet business, it was vitally important to have a spreadsheet that was portable. So you could provide a compatible spreadsheet on all these different systems that were going to divvy up the market. And Lotus put all their money on the IBM PC, and they optimized the hell out of the system for the IBM PC, and so it actually performed substantially better than Multiplan. And when the IBM PC took over, Multiplan's portability strategy was wrecked. So then there was Microsoft desperately trying to make it in the office systems business against the entrenched competitors, WordPerfect and Lotus, and it wasn't working very well. Microsoft did manage to gain market share very slowly during the late 80s and early 90s, sort of 1 point at a time. But I think at the time that Windows was introduced, the first successful Windows was introduced, we only had 30% or so of the word processing and spreadsheet markets. And so how did we go from 30% to 90% in the space of 3 or 4 years? Well, the basic rule of these things is that in a market segment, mass market software we're talking about here, in a market segment where there's an established leader, you cannot displace that leader except by changing the rules. There's so much advantage to being an established leader. There's essentially, you have to change the market in some fairly dramatic way. So what did Microsoft do? It was a very interesting study, I think. Two things. First of all, there was Windows. Microsoft, in the applications, really embraced Windows. And there were two reasons why it was relatively easy for us to do that. One was that, of course, we were building the Windows system. And so there was, we understood it really well, and there was a lot of pressure from the senior management to do that, to make the applications and the Windows system reinforce each other. The second reason was that we did have very successful applications for the Mac, spreadsheet and word processor, that in fact dominated the Mac, the tiny Mac office productivity market. And those applications had already addressed all the problems of building a good GUI-oriented application. Whereas when WordPerfect and Lotus wanted to do this, they pretty much had to start from scratch, because they had either no Mac applications or pretty unsuccessful ones. So those were that was one big advantage that Microsoft had. When GUIs came along in the PC world in a big way with Windows, the Microsoft Office apps were ready for it. That was one big change in the rules. The other big change in the rules that happened at the same time was that Microsoft introduced the idea of an Office suite. So you could buy Microsoft Office, word processor, spreadsheet, and presentation package. And we actually went out and bought PowerPoint. We didn't have a presentation package, but we bought one and we sort of pseudo-integrated it. And we sold it as a suite. Well, WordPerfect had the market-leading word processor, but they didn't have any spreadsheet. They didn't have any presentation package, and they had to really scramble to get those things. And then they weren't very well integrated, and they weren't very good. Lotus had the world's best spreadsheet, but they didn't have a word processor, and they didn't have a presentation package, and they had to scramble to get those things. So there were these two major changes in the rules that made it possible to completely displace the existing market leaders.
So, Butler, I think there's one other factor. It seems to me that Lotus bought the OS2 story hook, line, and sinker, and there are parts of Microsoft that didn't, is my impression. So that there was a point in time in which Lotus's next release was only going to run on OS2. And Microsoft had two next releases, one that would run on OS2 and one that would run on whatever the next version of Windows was. And when OS2 turned out to be lame and Windows turned out to be good, Microsoft sort of caught up a release, is my impression.
That might well be true. I don't know too much about that. But I think that factor is probably pretty secondary to the two things that I enumerated. Because typically, one release more or less is not really that critical. These products don't change that dramatically from release to release unless you're going through a rules change.
Got it.
So that's my guess. But I don't really know the details of that. So there might be a lot in that.
I also remember a lot of people saying Office would open WordPerfect files just fine, not the other way around. So if you're only going to buy one, and you had to work with other people, you were pretty much forced into using Office.
Yeah, but everybody was using WordPerfect.
Right. Well, the
so that was something. That's something that it's essential for the number two guy to do. But it wouldn't have been enough if you hadn't had this rules change.
Oh, right.
Yeah, you have to. Once you had the rules change, if you want to take, of course, you have to facilitate conversion as much as you possibly can. That's essential. If you put roadblocks in the way of conversion, then it won't be enough to do a rules change. But even if you work really hard on that, you still won't succeed in displacing the leader unless there's some really compelling reason for people to switch, and that typically means that you have to change the rules. Otherwise, the reason just won't be compelling enough. This is my theory of mass market software development, anyway.
Question for Microsoft.
So this sorry, did somebody have another question?
Yes. Question for Microsoft is, could you please switch to the back to the previous slide?
Sure.
You said that StarOffice was unsuccessful because it was too expensive, meaning that hardware was too expensive. And StarOffice was written on Mesa, so we can say it was portable. So there was a possibility to port it onto other hardware.
I'm sorry, to port what?
To port the StarOffice, to run it on
IBM. That was very, very, very difficult to port Star.
Okay.
It was really not.
Maybe you can run
it was done successfully years and years later, but it could never have been done in 1981.
Okay.
One more question?
Yes.
I'm not sure if you're planning to talk about it, but could you spend a little bit of time talking about how Ethernet was standardized and how that affected Xerox?
Well, I guess. There was this consortium of DEC, Xerox, and Intel, which got together and agreed on the Ethernet standard. Each company had its own reasons for wanting to do that, but they didn't really compete with each other, so it was pretty conflict-free. It was much more important for DEC than it was for Xerox. Because all we really cared about with Ethernet was that you could use it as the networking for Star. And, you know, compatibility with lots of other things wasn't really that important. It was very important to DEC's strategy.
So one thing that I think is worth noting, right, I just remember this from Salzer talking at the time, that the standardized Ethernet extended the prototype in sort of every direction, from 3 megabits to 10, from 1 kilometer to 2.5, from 100 stations to 256, I don't know. And in some sense, this was analog engineering, so the prototype experience was in some ways invalidated, and it took a couple of years for it to actually successfully get to market.
Jerry always says that sort of thing.
We could have rolled out 3 megabit Ethernet in no time, and 10 megabit Ethernet took a couple of years.
Yeah, but there wasn't much market demand for it, so it wasn't a big issue. It could have been done more quickly if there had been more aggressive market demand.
Okay.
But when you bring out a qualitatively new thing like that, it takes people quite a while to figure out that they really want it. There's lots more to be said about the evolution of Ethernet, but not in this talk. So just to summarize the things we talked about, what went wrong with Xerox's attempts to exploit the work that was done at Park in the 70s? We talked about printing. Xerox was focused on high-end copiers and printers. They didn't think there was any money on the low end. And they were focused on the computer printing business. They were focused on targeting the existing computer printing market. They weren't really interested in office printing. Of course, the Star had office printing, but they didn't regard office printing as an interesting market, which is completely consistent with the fact that they didn't believe in the low end. And needless to say, this turned out to be a huge mistake, and Apple and HP won this market and made huge amounts of money off of it. And this was just this was not something quite localized like the SDD Star phenomenon. This was a corporate-wide bias against the low end, which was by no means restricted to computer printing or electronics or anything like that. The Star system, I talked about this, the engineers had this great vision, was 10 years ahead of its time, and it was too expensive and too inflexible. And the other thing, of course, they were very unlucky that it came out in the same year as the IBM PC. It was just overwhelmed by the IBM PC wave. And as I said, the researchers pushed for something much more like the Alta, which would have been much less integrated, much less beautiful, could have been implemented in hardware much more like the Mac hardware. So Xerox did make a lot of money on high-end computer printing based on the work that was done at Park. They didn't make any money on anything else that was done at Park, as far as I know, except for one amusing little story that I just can't resist telling. In about 1976 or 7, maybe as a byproduct of the Boca Raton Conference, the people in Xerox who were designing the next generation of mid-range copiers came to us and they said, we're designing a very modular copier family where you can plug in lots of sorters and stackers and this and that and the other thing. And we've been trying to figure out how we're going to control all this stuff, and we just cannot figure out how to do the wiring. You guys are supposed to, it costs too much. You guys are supposed to be systems experts. Tell us what we should do. So we scratched our head about this for several weeks, and we finally came up with a conclusion that we were pretty sure was right, and we were also pretty sure that they would never accept it. So what we said was, Xerox had just bought built an IC fab line in Los Angeles. So we said, take your IC fab line, take the Ethernet, the 3 megabit Ethernet, and copy it gate for gate onto a chip. And then, instead of putting in lots of wires for the individual signals, give each module of the copier a processor and an Ethernet. In fact, we originally proposed they should have one chip with the processor and the Ethernet integrated onto the one chip. And just run one Ethernet wire around the whole thing. And we thought this would be much too wild and crazy for them, and they would never buy it. But they did. They actually engineered this chip. They thought it was too risky to try to put the processor and the Ethernet on one chip, so they kept two chips. They slowed it down by a factor of two, so it was only 1.5 megabits per second instead of three. It was still far more bandwidth than they needed to control this copier. They did a careful analysis of the real-time requirements and convinced themselves that they were going to load the Ethernet sufficiently lightly that it would be fine. And this was a huge success, and they saved lots and lots of money manufacturing copiers by using this single chip, 1.5 megabit Ethernet, internally to the copier. And as I say, that was a big surprise to us. We were serious when we made the proposal. We were astonished when it was accepted. And nobody knows about this story. It was never documented anywhere. Okay, so what did other people do? Well, we talked about Ethernet already. Laser printing and PostScript. There was Adobe and Canon and HP, so Canon made the engines for both Adobe and HP. Apple. Adobe made the software. HP actually made a bigger success out of low-end laser printing with their much kludgier PCL family of languages because it was well adapted to the needs of the IBM PC, which was where most of the market was. And of course, you know how that's evolved over the last 10 years. Apple did the Lisa, which was not successful, basically for the same reasons the Star was not successful. Then they did the Macintosh, which they got it down to be cheap enough and open enough that it was able to succeed. And that was great. Microsoft did Windows. We did several iterations of Windows that were absolute disasters. And finally, we did Windows 3.1, which was good enough to succeed and eventually take over the IBM market. And we also did Word, which grew, as I said, directly out of Bravo. The workstation business didn't come directly out of it. The Altool was recognizably a workstation, but the thrust of what Apollo and Sun did when they built workstations was engineering and scientific computing. So Sun ran Unix and Apollo had their own system designed from scratch. But their focus was on meeting the needs of scientists and engineers, so they had Fortran and things like that. And of course that was extremely successful. Eventually it was overwhelmed by PCs, but it was very successful for 15 years. In networking, PUP never took off because it was overwhelmed by the internet, but Novell did adopt a lot of the standards that were designed by SDD, building on the work that had been done at Park. And file and print servers, similarly, we built the first file and print servers at Park, and Novell, of course, made an excellent business out of that. They did that by building an operating system that was basically specialized for the needs of a file and print server. And that was great as long as that was the only thing that customers wanted. Eventually, they were wiped out by Windows NT, which was not as good as a file and print server, but it could do a lot of other things as well. And when customers' needs expanded, it was extremely difficult for Novell to move off of that of that file print server-based operating system, because, of course, they had all kinds of terrible compatibility problems and didn't really have the right skill set and all those things that you'd expect. And so in the end, they got overwhelmed. It took a while, because for a long time, the only servers that people really wanted in the PC world were file and print servers. And Novell was great for that. Questions about all that? That's kind of a cursory summary of where things went. Lots of companies got started, and, you know, many tens of billions of dollars of market cap were accumulated. Lots of Park alumni got rich and all that good stuff.
So looking back at all this, such big leaps forward make a lot of the things we do today seem very natural. So what...
There's been one huge leap forward since Park, right? And it was the web.
So what would you say is fundamental? What is the limiting factor for us today?
I mean, where's the next big leap going to come from?
Or why doesn't... What is limiting us to, or today, in doing such big leaps? Is it just that we're in the beginning of this industry?
I'm going to talk about that a little bit at the end. So let's hold off until
then.
Maybe
we'll
come back to your question.
Why don't we let you...
plunge ahead.
Do your thing,
all right.
And then do questions at the end if there is end
right.
at the end.
So I showed you a truncated version of this picture. This is the whole bushy tree picture. It's got a Memex up at the top, and it's got Windows XP down at the bottom. And the red circle still outlines the stuff that was done at Park. And you get the idea that there's lots of interconnections and lots of dependencies and all that good stuff. Where are we today? Well, today's PC, as I explained an hour ago, is about 10,000 times as good as the Alto, pretty much across the board. A cycle, RAM, disk, networking, across the board. The display is not 10,000 times better. It's only about 50 or 100 times better. So where did all these resources go? It doesn't do 10,000 times as much as the Alto did, right? Maybe it does 20 times as much, upper bound. So where did it go? Well, you know, a lot went into visual fidelity and visual elegance. A lot went into integration. Integration is expensive. A lot has gone into backward compatibility. We didn't worry about that in the Alto. We wanted to have a new release. Maybe we had a conversion program for the old files, but that was the absolute limit of it. A lot of it went into scale. You can do books in Word now, not just 20-page memos. A lot of it went in, quite a bit of it went into response time, but this is the biggest thing. Resources are being pissed away in order to be able to ship the products quicker. And that is a good engineering trade-off. If you put more time into it, you could use less resources. That is not a good deal. Moore's Law means that you should not do that. If you want to succeed in the marketplace, you should just make it as good as it needs to be to have acceptable performance and ride the Moore's Law curve. And this offends a lot of people, but that's the way the world is. Did we foresee that this would happen? Of course we did. We understood Moore's Law perfectly well in the mid-70s. And I wrote, in fact, in 1972, I wrote a short paper projecting what's going to happen in computing in the next 20 years. And yes, definitely, we thought there'd be a machine on every desk that could do all the things that the Alto could do. I don't think we foresaw this 10,000 times, and we would have been puzzled to know how you were going to use all those resources. Because we didn't understand, as well as we do today, the power of, you know, layering things on top of other things and chewing up resources that way. What about tomorrow? Well, this is one slide on why computing is still interesting. Alan Kay said the best way to predict the future is to invent it. So a lot of people think computers are boring now. As you said, the last interesting thing that happened was the web, and that was almost 15 years ago now. Here's my capsule story about that. Computers are basically good for three things. I touched on this earlier. They're good for simulation. That's how we got started. They're good for communication. That's what we did at Park, and that's what the internet did, and that's what the web does. Cycle time for one of these things is about 25 or 30 years. Not that the old one goes away. Simulation is still very important. Communication is still very important. What's going to be next? My idea is that what's going to be next is embodiment, which means, by which I mean non-trivial interactions with the physical world. So I've been predicting for two decades that the next decade would be the decade of the household robot. And so far it's been an almost complete bust, but there now is a household robot. It's called a Roomba. They've sold a couple yeah. million of them. I don't know, have any of you seen it?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. And under the appropriate circumstances, it actually works quite well.
Yeah.
The computing budget for the Roomba is 40 cents. It has about 10 or 12,000 bytes of ROM, and get this, 256 bytes of RAM. And that's the current state of the art in household robots, but I think more great things can happen. If you want to know all the really wonderful things that I think can happen in computing that will make it qualitatively different than it is today, I recommend that you go to Jim Gray's webpage at research.microsoft.com and look at his Turing Award lecture, where he gives a list of 10 exciting problems in computer science that we should be able to attack successfully in the next 10 or 20 years.
There's a
brief summary of it is there's robotics, there's computers that can really see, hear, talk, and understand, and there's actually getting information from your fingertips. There's a great slogan that nobody ever delivered on. Google's come closest, but still a huge amount to do. So that's my story about how computing is still really exciting, and I think Jim Gray gives a considerably more detailed account of things that look like really good things to work on. That's the end of my slides.
We're at the hour. Does anybody have one or two questions that they'd like to ask before we thank our speaker?
So actually one final question from UW here. So obviously PARC and other organizations benefited from federally funded research that came out of ARCA.
Mm-hmm.
The trend has been that funding is going down and will probably continue to go down.
That's bad.
How concerned are you about that? And do you think organizations like MSR help mitigate it?
Do I think organizations like?
Like Microsoft Research.
Well, we do what we can, but you know, it's just one organization. There's lots of very high-powered talent that we can't tap, and it's not good to have the primary fortunes of computing research in the hands of one organization. I think that's profoundly unhealthy. We worried about that actually quite a bit at PARC in the mid-70s when we were attracting an overwhelming fraction of the top talent that was coming out of PhD programs. I think it's bad. I think it's very short-sighted for the country. I can't do anything about it.
Neither can Ed, evidently.
It's definitely, I think it's really stupid. You know, maybe NSF will get a lot more money, and that'll help. I think it was much better to have the old system where you had ARPA and NSF with very different styles of supporting research. Because I'm a firm believer in the proposition that diversity is good. This was enunciated really well in the Book Sutherland report that came out from the National Academies in 1995. A single model for evaluating and funding research is bad because it's going to favor some things at the expense of others.
Yeah.
You know, NSF has this peer review model, which has some virtues and it has some major drawbacks. And ARPA had a completely different model. Basically, you do it at the whim of the program managers. And that obviously has severe drawbacks too, but it also has advantages. I think it's really bad that ARPA is behaving in such a brain-dead fashion in many areas. Some areas, they're still doing fine. So I think actually the magnitude of the problem is somewhat less than people like Ed and I are inclined to think, because the areas that we like and that have historically been well supported by ARPA have been hit much worse than other areas.
Anyone else?
Marty?
Do you have any thoughts about what changes should be made in engineering education and research universities?
What changes should be made in engineering education in research universities? That's a terrifyingly difficult problem. Every now and then I think about, well, what would I do if I was just trying to teach computer science to undergraduates, which I don't do. I only teach it to graduate students, and only occasionally. It's just scary. I don't know how you should teach undergraduates about computing. There's so many different tracks you could take. What's really important for them to understand? when you teach graduate students, it's not that much of a problem because they're supposed to be able to take care of themselves. But the undergraduates, you can really wreck them up. That's very scary. And I'm sorry, I have no clue. I know that I did a rotten job teaching undergraduates when I was on the faculty at Berkeley.
When were you in the faculty?
So there's a bunch of other stuff developed at Park, presumably, that you haven't talked about. Are there any projects or programs that you're surprised haven't made it out to the real world?
A lot of the other stuff did make it out. There's a lot of work done on Lisp, for example, and certain aspects of artificial intelligence. That was all published. There was the Mead Conway work on VLSI design, which was certainly very successful. That was entirely out of my scope, so I didn't talk about that at all. This is slightly overstated, but voice over IP, which is today very hot, originated at Park. We were the first people to build a packet-based phone system, which we actually deployed in all of CSL in the early, around 1983 or 84. It was built on this 1.5 megabit single-chip Ethernet that was developed for the copier. And it was very successful, and then it was completely forgotten for 15 years. So there's that. But all these things were published.
I guess, are there any other sort of... So I know, like, the tablet PC kind of came out.
No, it didn't. That was only a dream. We had no way to implement it. The small talk guys built a thing called NoteTaker, but it was a disaster. It was a perfect example. I was strongly opposed to it. And in my opinion, the way it came out fully justified my opposition because basically it was too soon. The technology wasn't up to it. And the thing you could build was not interesting. It was too big and too heavy and too slow and totally uninteresting. And it wasn't really possible to build. We built a prototype tablet PC at DEC-CERC in 1994. It was called Lectrice. And if you're curious about it, there's an extremely comprehensive tech report that you can find by searching the web. But it wasn't really possible to build commercial tablet PCs until about 2000. Because people have been very interested in it, and I've been very interested in it personally. The one we built at Park in 1975, the one we built at CERC in 94, 95, cost about $7,000. So, you know, that was a nice prototype, but it was completely impractical as a product. But I worked on the tablet PC group at Microsoft when we did the tablet PC software. I don't think it could have been done successfully much sooner. Because the fundamental rule, in my view, for that was for the tablet PC to succeed, it had to actually be a PC, not some weird new thing. Why is that? Because there's so much stuff for the PC, and you can't make a tablet PC cheap enough that people will just treat it as an auxiliary thing that they're willing to have. You can't make it cheap enough, and you can't make it small and light enough that they want to carry it around along with their laptop. So if it's not a PC, it's not going to succeed. That's a pretty severe constraint. We can talk about this more offline if you want. I mean, I know a lot about that. I thought about it a lot. But certainly, the tablet PC was Alan's dream from the beginning, but there was no way it could be implemented at Park.
I guess the question was, are there other things sort of like that on the horizon?
Dreams? Absolutely. You mean things that people imagined at Park that couldn't be implemented at the time? I don't know. I haven't thought about that. I'm a very down-to-earth kind of guy. I don't like to work on research that I can't see some plausible way to implement within 3 or 4 years. And I'm willing to wait a few more years maybe for it to turn into a product, but I want to be able to build it and see it reasonably soon. That's, other people have different styles.
Yeah.
But my view about systems research is you don't really know what you're doing until you've built the thing. And if you can't build it, it's crippling. And if you can only build something that's really half-assed, that's crippling too. Because you'll never know whether you got it right. My favorite example of this is DEC-CERC in the early 90s, we built a replicated file system. And the primary motivation for it was the idea that since all the replication stuff would be automated, management would be a lot easier. Because a lot of the things that management does have to do with, you know, reconfiguring around failed hardware and moving stuff around from hither to yon and so forth. And we put it into service, and we were astonished to find that it took more management time, not less, totally contrary to the experimental hypothesis. So we backed off and we thought about it, and we discovered something that should, in retrospect, have been totally obvious from the beginning, but it wasn't. And that was, a replication system actually has a lot of knobs. It's possible to write programs to set all those knobs, but we didn't write those programs. So the poor managers had to set the knobs. And we just didn't think about this. It's the kind of thing that you just, even though it was totally obvious in retrospect, if you don't build the system, you're never going to know. So, I don't believe in this business of imagining the thing that you can't build for 20 years. I mean, yeah, it's okay as an inspiration, but it doesn't really count, in my view.
Butler, thank you very much. This is fantastic. Thanks a million.
You bet.